This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and to expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Do Black lives really matter? Do they matter in Somalia, where the United States is right now waging a war against the Somali people? Do brown lives matter? In Yemen, where the United States and Saudi Arabia have been killing people for years? Do brown lives matter in Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan? All places where the United States is still actively at war. At the recent protests against the killing of George Floyd, I have seen virtually every left-wing cause represented. Everything from indigenous rights to women's rights to climate change. But I have still, to this day, seen no mention of foreign policy, no mention of these wars, no mention of the fact that the United States government has been killing black and brown people around the world for decades. One would think that a movement under the banner Black Lives Matter would care. But I don't blame them entirely, because it seems to me that virtually no Americans care. This is why these wars are now called, by the few of us who follow them, the Endless Wars. We're trying to correct that on Unregistered, and so we're bringing onto the show this week an expert, one of the leading experts on these wars. He is both an expert academically, he's been a journalist covering them, and he served in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is my interview with Major Danny Scherson. I am here with Danny Scherson, who joins us from Lawrence, Kansas. And Danny is a retired major in the U.S. Army. And I have to always look up the ranks because I'm one of these just total larval idiot civilians who knows nothing about the hard life of the military. And I'll, even though I'm a historian of the military, I guess technically, I had to actually look up where is the major rank among in the military. And so what is the major, Danny? And what did you do? And who was under your command, if anybody? And what does that mean?
Yeah, so being a major is a weird spot. You're kind of at a pivot or inflection point in your career. So in my current life, first, it means that I'm suspicious and distrusted by everyone in the anti-war movement who's a veteran, because the lower enlisted guys and the younger officers are like, oh, he's too high ranking. He's a company man. You know, he's maybe he's a plant, right? The military might have sent him in. I mean, he even has pretty short hair until COVID, and he's pretty clean cut still. And then the like colonels and generals who write op-eds for the Washington Post, they're skeptical of you because they're like, oh, he's a washed up major who couldn't make colonel or something, which there's a lot of complexity in that. I left on a medical retirement a little early, which is why I didn't make colonel. But
so you're high up. So hold on. The only people above you are the colonels, lieutenant generals, and generals, right?
Right. So the way it works is there's three types. There's three varieties of officer as you move through. There's the company grade officers. That's the second lieutenants. First lieutenants, mm-hmm. captains, in order. Mm-hmm. Right. They're sort of the where the rubber meets the road guys. They actually interact with soldiers. They call airstrikes. You know, they coordinate that stuff. They actually know what soldiers do, although a lot of enlisted soldiers will tell you that a lot of even those officers are kind of like pie in the sky. Right. And then there's the field grade officers, and they're the bureaucrats. They're the ones who run the system, and they're the majors, lieutenant colonels, and full bird colonels. And then there's the flag officers, which is the generals, the admirals, depending on Army or Navy. Now, what's interesting about the rank of major is you're sort of like the bitch who runs the machine of the officers. I mean, that's what people say, like a major, oh, he's just some colonel's bitch, because you don't command. It's the only rank, really, where you don't ever command troops, like where you're not the direct commander. So what I mean is lieutenants, first and second, command platoons, right? They're in charge of a platoon of 20 to 40 guys. A company commander, which is really like the main functioning cohort, you know, within the military. That's how business is done. He commands 100 to 200 guys, or 250 guys. And then lieutenant colonels take command of battalions, which is 5 to 700. The major is a professional staff officer. So he's the second in command or the third in command of that battalion. So a battalion of like 5 to 700 infantrymen or scouts or whatever, is a lieutenant colonel in charge of all of it, five captains who are in charge of like 100 to 150 of each of them. But in the middle are these two lonely majors. And one of them is the executive officer. He's the second in command. So if the colonel dies or is absent, he takes command. And he runs like the logistics. That's his primary day job. And the operations officer, the other major, is the third in command. And he runs operations. He actually plans the missions. He's the guy. So these two dudes make the battalion run, and the colonel does no work usually. I mean, they take pride on it. Like, I'm a commander. I walk around and talk to people. You make things happen. I give guidance. I delegate. So they're the operational sort of like bureaucrats. Majors are the most unpopular officers usually in the army because they're associated with minutiae and they're associated with like detail and bureaucracy and being in captain's butts all the time. And they don't get to do the happy, like slap soldiers on the back stuff that colonels do. So it's a really weird rank. It's an important one, but I left at the most miserable moment in one's career. I don't know if that affects my viewpoint, but it's an important rank. And then of course the generals are a whole other thing, at a higher level and do even less, you know, actual like work.
Yeah, so but you were very high up in the army, right? That's a very high rank. And you said you're the highest ranking member of the anti-war vets organizations you're a part of, right? And you were just sort of saying that some people actually haven't trusted you. They've assumed that you're a plant because there's no way a major could be an anti-war activist. So this is the other thing people don't know, is that you're now also a major anti-war activist and journalist, and you're published in many, many different political outlets that are anti-war, usually on the left, but you're well known in that world. And you were a major in the Army, though, not that long ago, right? When did you retire?
Yeah, so I officially retired February of 2019. So it's 18 months, right?
So you were like a boss in the Army two years ago or less, and now you're like a boss in the anti-Army movement.
it's a bizarre sort of reality. I feel like I retired a lot longer ago because I sort of mentally retired before that, but I did have the odd experience the last 3 years where I was writing first dozens and then hundreds of articles a year, or over 100 articles a year, all anti-war, highly provocative while on active duty. So yeah, I was this like serving major. I think one of the most bizarre moments was when I was at the Command and General Staff College, which is kind of the school for majors. It's like our academic university. So 50% of majors get selected to go to that school, right? So the rule of thumb is like, even of all the people who make major, which is only about, I think it was about 60% my year, of that, only half of them get chosen to go to this prestigious, you know, Command and General Staff College of Fort Leavenworth, which is why I live in Kansas now.
Right.
But while I'm there and I'm studying like how to deploy a brigade to the Crimea, I mean, I could tell you the operations we worked on, which is fascinating and instructive, but while that's happening, by day, I'm like literally planning how to like get troops into Azerbaijan on its way to fight in the Caucasus. And then by night or by day, while I'm not paying attention to class, I was writing anti-war articles. But yes, in the anti-war movement, there are a few colonels who are active voices, but in terms of the people who are in like the streets, for lack of a better word, who don't just like write, and I'm not putting any value on that, but the ones who don't just write, but like go to the direct action and stuff. I mean, at least in about face,
like the ones who wear peace t-shirts, for instance.
Right. Yeah. And when we do action with about face veterans against the war, veterans peace, I I think I'm the highest ranking in both organizations that is active.
Right. Have you been feeling especially anxious lately? I know I have. In fact, I've been feeling especially anxious for about 5 months now. I think it has something to do with this lockdown that has kept us all in a cage and made us crazy. The Centers for Disease Control confirmed this. Recently, they announced that prevalence of anxiety disorder in the United States has tripled over the same time last year. Thank you, governors. The good news is that we have many medications to deal with anxiety. The bad news is some of them are not so good for you. Some of them are very addictive, and some of them are made from chemicals. Others are not addictive and come from plants. That's why I have always preferred CBD, and I have used it for my own anxiety disorder for years. Recently, I've had to use it quite a lot, which is why I'm so grateful that our sponsor now is a CBD company that's giving us all unregistered listeners incredible discounts for fantastic products. Paloma Verde Store, Paloma Verde CBD, the store in San Antonio, Texas, run by Carlos and Vanessa Abelar, is offering all unregistered listeners a 25% discount on every single product they have. On top of that, if you just join their mailing list, you get another 10%. Also, Carlos and Vanessa have put together my three favorite products that I use daily. This is called the Unregistered Combo Pack, but between us, they call it the THAD Pack. In the THAD Pack, you get their fantastic, delicious fruit-flavored gummies. You get their soft gels. I take 2 or 3 or 4 a day, depending on how bad the lockdown is feeling. And then my favorite is their high-potency tincture, which you put some drops under your tongue, and I promise you, your anxiety will melt away almost immediately. Go to PalomaVerdeStore.com, put in the discount code RENEGADE, get some products to help you, and make your life better. Thank you so much. Okay, so you're, how old are you, 36?
I turned 37. This is my birthday. I'm 37 today.
Happy birthday, Danny.
Thank you.
Happy birthday.
I'm 37, and I forgot it was my birthday, and I overbooked myself and double booked myself on my birthday, which I really need to just take a hard look at my personal life, I think.
But I and we are honored. I speak for the listeners too. So you're 37 years old. You're a retired major, big deal in the U.S. Army. You're an anti-war activist. You also are a professional historian on your way to being a professional historian. You are finishing your dissertation for your PhD in history at the Kansas University, correct?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
In U.S. history, my field, brother.
That's right. Yes. And in civil rights history, of all things.
Like, good God.
Talk about the most like unmilitary topic, nothing to do, or at least not on the surface, anything to do with what I write about. There's some odd components obviously to the story, I suppose, when I think about it.
So, I mean, okay. So 37, retired major in the Army, leading anti-war activist, journalist and historian, and really a historian. That's a lot right now you got going on there. And that's quite a position you are in your life. Like if you just pause here, like take a snapshot of where you are, that's who you are sort of on paper. That's a big, whatever it is, it's a big deal, and that's who you are now. Now I want to go back 36 years, right? You were born in a very different kind of place, and you were born to do very different things, and you took all kinds of directions you weren't supposed to take. But where were you born?
I was born in Staten Island.
I've heard of it.
Staten Island, New York City, forgotten borough, Trump country. Very complicated place, but I grew up on the East Shore, which is kind of the, for folks who know New York at all, it's the borderland between the like affluent and completely white South Shore and the much more diverse, you know, Wu-Tang North Shore, right? Not that that's all it is, but the best way to think of it is like there's two Staten Islands and then there's the middle ground. And the two Staten Islands, there's like Method Man Staten Island up north, and then there's like Sammy the Bull Gravano's Staten Island down south. And like literally those are people from Staten Island, but then there's kind of like the borderland, you know, for these borderlands historians out there, right, who know that stuff. But it was like that. I'm from not from like an impoverished family or something, but like it's a very working class, not an intellectual family, not a particularly educated family. My mom's side, who I lived with mainly and was probably closest with, it's like three generations deep in the fire department.
Oh, wow.
my uncles were cops first, because the waiting list was always longer because more people want to be firemen because they're more popular with women and it's a better job. Definitely. Right. It's just like you get more time off and you get to like sleep and BS at the firehouse. So I think the expectation was probably that I would be like a little bit smarter than your average bear firefighter, maybe. When I was a kid, my grandfather and his friends used to call me Chief Dan when I would go to the firehouse to visit. Like, I'm looking right now at a picture of me wearing my grandfather's helmet when I'm 3 on his lap, because he worked till he was like 61. He was like one of the oldest firemen on the line, still working on the line in the houses when he retired. And he had been like super decorated, gotten like the equivalent of the Medal of Honor for the fire department earlier in his career. It was a big deal. Like, his plaque is up in the firehouse. You know, I could still walk in there and say who my grandfather was. It's like that world. So yeah, they would call me Chief Dan because it was like I was a kind of a smart little kid. And so, but to show the thinking, it was like, well, he's smart, so he'll just be like a higher ranking firefighter. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Not like maybe he'll go be an intellectual.
Right.
But then as I got older, it became sort of apparent that maybe I was college material and going to go in a different direction. But the, I guess the point is, it was not the kind of place. Most of my friends in the neighborhood didn't go to college. A lot of people who went to high school did, because I went to kind of like a public school, but kind of magnety from the whole island. So those folks that I met there did. But yeah, I mean, I think I was the second in my extended family to go to any college. And, you know, that was City College, right? So, I mean, not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you know, we could talk about it, but yeah, it was West Point, right? So it was this whole other thing. But I guess the point of the story is, in this part, in terms of background, is paramilitary sort of like culture, which is real in New York City, especially in Staten Island. There's that Sylvester Stallone movie about a town in northern New Jersey called Copland, right? It wasn't a great or popular movie, but it was like the late 90s, and it's all about how like that culture works and the loyalty of the cops, and it's like us versus everybody and an entire town where all the cops who live and who work in New York City live. Well, parts of Staten Island were like that.
Yeah.
And it was us against them sort of attitude. Like, so you have a lot of cops in Staten Island who work in the projects in Staten Island, but more so like up in the Bronx or East New York and Brooklyn. And then they return home to their mostly whitish neighborhoods in Staten Island, which does have a different feel than much of the city, depending on what part of Staten Island. And that attitude was, yeah, it permeates. And it's part of the reason, I think, that there are people in my family who won't speak to me now, which is interesting because we were all very close.
Yeah, we bonded early on when we first met, because I told you that one of my very first jobs was as a Night City reporter for the Staten Island Advance. When I was in college, I had an internship, but it became a real reporting job. I was a Night City reporter for 3 months. And so I got to know that borough very well when no one of my age who was living in New York seemed to care. You know, the college educated elite that I was running around with didn't even know that Staten Island existed. And I would be on the ferry every night at midnight going to my job to report on all the doings of your lovely borough. And one of the things that was striking to me as a kid from an atheist commie family in Berkeley was how chock full, this was in the 1980s, this was before the black population got that big. There was one, but it wasn't nearly as big as it is now. How chock full the damn place was of Catholics, Irish and Italian in particular, right? And with sort of that kind of old school Northeastern cultural conservatism, but also a whole lot of pregnant teenagers, I noticed, going into Manhattan for various reasons, I noticed. Cops and firefighters, yes, abound in neighborhoods like that. And that's exactly where you come from. People, I think, have seen that kind of culture. Like you said, Copland's a great movie that depicts that. You know, we know a lot about that culture. Schersen, where is that from? Is that like Scandinavian or is it Danish?
Yeah. So I'm like most folks from that area, but you have to sort of pick sides of like the cultural divide. So I'm like an eighth Norwegian. That's what it is. My father's father was Norwegian. My mom is more Irish, but she's not even 100%. My dad is like Italian and Norwegian. And so, by the way, my family's in a civil war because my parents are divorced. But like one of their sticking points of like argument was like my dad identified as Italian, even though he's only half Italian. And my mom identified as Irish, even though she was only half Irish. But, you know, I always joke with people from the Midwest. Like I'll meet and date a woman and we'll talk about our backgrounds. And I'll say like, well, where I'm from, like, you know, your ethnicity matters. Like, whereas if you're from the Midwest, a lot of times it's like you're either white, you're black, or you're Mexican, or maybe you're Native American. like where I'm from, people are like, what are you? And they mean, where are your great grandparents from?
Which country
you've never been to.
Right.
Right. But in Staten Island, at least, especially on my side, you identified as either Irish or Italian.
Yeah.
And that was like a social thing. It was like class thing a little bit, because usually the Italians were the wealthier South Shore kids. And so they were like more like popular, cool in school usually and stuff. So, you know, you could be like Polish and not Irish at all, but you have like paler skin and you have bluish eyes. And so you don't really, and you don't have like the money to have like the Mercedes, like some of the Italians from Tottenville or the neighborhoods in the South Shore. So you just get labeled in with the Irish. So people would be like, hey, what's that dude? And, oh, he's Irish. But he's not. He's like 100% Polish, you know. So, but it just shows that there's like this divide that's not necessarily linked linear to what you really are. But it's a weird culture. It's like, I call it the Staten time warp, you know, because like time kind of stopped during like 72.
I remember one day I was on the ferry going to work at the Advance, and I freaked out because I was like, oh my God, I'm not kidding you. I was like, Jesus Christ, there's some like alien invasion, or everybody's been drugged, because everybody on the Staten Island train, once I got to Staten Island, had a dot on their forehead. It was Ash Wednesday. I didn't even know anything about Catholicism, right? I was like, oh my God, but no one in Manhattan had that, and everyone in Staten Island had it. So it really is a world apart, and it's very Catholic and very conservative in that way. 9/11. Talk about 9/11 on Staten Island. What happened? You were there, right?
Well, I was at West Point. But it was real. I mean, it was like very visceral. Okay, so I had gone to West Point on July 2nd, 2001 to start basic training, which was 5 days after I graduated high school. Because, you know, in New York, you graduate later than like in the Midwest. And so I had like 5 days to like just get all my alcohol and like women in. And then I went to basic training while everyone else is like partying before they start college or prison or whatever is in their future. And so I had very different expectations about what the Army meant, right? So to me, the Army meant like tough training, maybe a bit in Kosovo, take some cool pictures, and I'm not going to die. There's not going to be a real war. We don't fight those anymore since Vietnam. Like Persian Gulf War was a video game, you know, our casualties were so low. So that was the expectation, right? And I'll get to travel to Germany and take cool pictures. I'm up there. I just finished basic training. My two uncles, several cousins are all still firefighters. My mom's still in Staten Island. They all still are. And then 9/11 hits and I'm in boxing class, right? Mandatory freshman plebes, we call us, boxing. It's like got to be, I think West Point and maybe the Naval Academy have to be the only institutions with mandatory boxing. So I was in there and, you know, we would warm up. We'd shadow box in the mirrors the first 5 minutes. Like it was like the thing, and someone ran in. It was a morning class and said, you know, something's going on with the World Trade Center. It's on fire or whatever. So very rare thing to break discipline. And the instructor let us run across the hallway into like the workout, like fitness cardio area. And we watched for like the rest, you know, like the 45 minutes. And I watched the second plane hit in real time, which was bizarre. You know, I mean, I'm in my boxing uniform at the military academy. And there was definitely this feel of something changed. Like, and I don't, and that's not me reading back. You know, I know we have a tendency to do that. At the moment, I and all of us who talked about it felt like, okay, the world did really just change for us in the sense that there's going to be a war probably. And my like reflex to that was very similar to like the nation's reflex and Bush's, but without going there, I think we knew this is a war. Now, what added interest to me in particular was, when the buildings come down and it's clear that it's not just going to be the people in the planes and the floor that got hit that are going to die, but when the buildings start collapsing, I definitely had the feeling of Steven and Chris are either both dead, one of them's dead, who knows, like where is my family, right? So that was, and we didn't hear from them because all the cell phone service and stuff went out. And so like I was, when I got back to my room, calling my mom and stuff because like class was like kind of pushed off, and I was able to just, so I was calling my mom and she's giving me updates. We haven't heard from Steven. We haven't heard from all our, you know, our whole family. And my dad worked across Church Street. He worked for the state disability office. He like was a, just like a case analyst, you know, he kind of like did paperwork for them. And so he worked across the street and I didn't hear from him. And so when the building came down, I don't think I understood how much damage was done to the, so I was thinking about him too. It was really bizarre. You know, he got out on the last ferry. I mean, he left early enough, and for a number of reasons, my uncles weren't there when the towers came down. And so they, you know, they both lived and they dug in the rubble for weeks. And, my uncle's best friend, who was kind of almost like family. He was, you know, Marty Egan, captain, for he died. Steve, they found his body, because one of the rare ones, he was outside the building, so they found him pretty intact. But yeah, I mean, but the output in Staten Island in particular was that per capita it had the most deaths. Per capita it had the most fire and cop deaths, of course, which is just because we have the most per capita. My mom went to like, she would have 35 or 40 funerals over the course of those months, because they were spread out whenever they'd find like a bone or something, or decide the family would decide to have it despite no body. I mean, my mom was like a professional wake and funeral goer. And then they started naming the streets in my neighborhood and others after these folks, a lot of firemen who'd been killed. And I knew a lot of them. It was just like the whole place pivoted on that moment. Like, and there was like a victim complex, and it was, I don't mean that in a bad way, just like, yeah. We felt like they became so pro-war because of it largely. And I understand why.
Right. All the flags went up. It was, I call it America's fascist moment. And it was not just in Staten Island. It was in Park Slope. I was in Park Slope right across, mm-hmm. right across the Verrazano Bridge there, on 9/11. And there were no American flags in that bougie liberal upscale neighborhood, on September 10th. And on September 12th, there was an American flag on every single stoop. And for many weeks, it was like that. And not only that, but all these liberal Democrat types who previously hated people like Giuliani and George Bush were talking about how great Giuliani and George Bush were, and that they were so glad that they were being protected by those two men. I mean, I'm not kidding you. That was like the common thing among like people now who would think that Trump is Hitler, you know, that demographic. They were applauding and loving the sort of father figures of Rudy Giuliani and George Bush at that moment. So, all right. So for you, though, when you saw that happening, you're at West Point. You clearly had a commitment and a strong interest in the military. You didn't believe you were going to be at war when you entered West Point, but you couldn't have been so naive that you didn't think it was a possibility, right? Yeah. And so when you saw the plane hit, it couldn't have been like, you know, oh my God, I wasn't supposed to go to war. But what were the feelings in your mind? I can tell you the feelings that were in my mind. Mostly fear, because I was taking the subway every day at that point, all the way from Brooklyn to the top of Manhattan, right underneath the Trade Center. I thought everybody thought Al-Qaeda was going to blow up the subway. Remember that? That was the thing. Really? Everybody was talking about that, and I was terrified of that. Quite a bit of fear, quite a bit of apprehension, knowing that we were most likely going to go to war. I was very anti-war at that point. Had been my whole life, actually, as a political person. But I have to say that on September 11th, that afternoon, my wife was 8 months pregnant with my son. And it was, I would say, let's be honest here. I would say for about 12 hours, I wanted something like a Green Beret operation to go in and kill some people. Justin Raimondo, as far as I know, to this day, I think, as far as I know, who was the editor of antiwar.com, which you write for, as far as I know, he's the only person on the planet who published an article the very next day on September 12th saying what we all now think, which is this is blowback. And if we go to war, it will only be worse, and it could end up in an endless war. Justin was totally right. It's one of the most brilliant pieces of journalism. Justin died, by the way, this last year, and was a very difficult human being. But like a lot of people, I loved him and hated him kind of in equal measure, but he was certainly the only one. So anyway, sorry to that little digression, but I always think back on that moment as being when America really was fascist, because everybody for a moment there, even these liberals who never thought about the nation state, suddenly merged their identity with the nation state and had American flags and everything. And it scared me. So after about 6 or 12 hours of having Green Beret fantasies, you know, of going in and chopping off bin Laden's head or whatever, I got over it and started to see exactly what it was. And I saw all these intellectuals, these liberal intellectuals making arguments for the war, yada, yada. Anyway, back to you. So, so I had a little vengeance. Did you have a little vengeance in your heart then?
Oh,
did you
want to
kill you some Arabs is what I'm getting at.
I hate this story. It's like this is the least favorite thing to say about myself. Like, mm-hmm. I would like to go back in time. I want to jump in the DeLorean and have a fist fight with my, like, I was 18. I mean, I turned 18 in the Army. My mom had to sign me in because I was still 17. And you can join the Army and go on active duty at 17 if your mother signs you in or your guardian. Mm-hmm. So that's not an excuse, but
yeah, it is.
My response was secret. You didn't say this out loud even at West Point because it was like that would have been considered like a tool bag thing. But like my secret feeling was that I was like excited that I was going to get to go to war and like show how special and masculine I was. I was going to get put this new like nascent training to use. I mean, the adulation that would come my way. I mean, this was like, we were going to respond in Pearl Harbor. We were going to be our grandparents who we always felt we could never measure up to, who had all been in World War II, who we all secretly knew were like better than us somehow because they were the greatest generation. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of that was going on at that moment and for probably that first couple of years. In fact, on St. Patrick's Day 2003, I was I was a sophomore at West Point, and I was in Manhattan, you know, in like Irish bars with my uncles just getting bombed, you know, underage. There was like no drinking age in Manhattan after 9/11. You show a military ID, like you're not only getting in the bar, like you're not paying for drinks. You wear an Army shirt.
Right.
I mean, everything. I mean, women, the whole deal. It was like ridiculous. But the point is, so here I am. I'm like loaded with my like uncles just being a nut job and like dancing to cheesy frat boy music. And like, there's stuff on TV about this. The war is about to start, you know. Mm-hmm. The bombing is about to start of Iraq now. So nothing to do with 9/11. And my biggest fear, even then, was I'm going to miss this war because I'm not even a junior yet. And it's going to be just like the Persian Gulf War. It's going to be over 100 hours, maybe 100 days, and I'll miss it. And all the guys who graduated in 2002 and maybe 2003, you're going to get that fancy combat patch on the right shoulder. So the insider baseball, a little bit on the military, is the unit that you're in, you wear the patch on your left shoulder, your right shoulder has an American flag. And if you've been to combat at any point in your career, for the rest of your career, you get to wear the patch of the unit you went to combat with. It's called a right shoulder patch or a combat patch. Ooh. So important is this in the military culture that even to this day, if you meet another soldier in uniform, we call it like the check. People will like look, and because it's a credibility check. Have you been in war? Mm-hmm. So that was really important then, because when I was at West Point, my instructors hadn't even been to war. Very mm-hmm. few of them. A couple of them were old enough that they were in Gulf War, so they had a combat patch. But I'd say 10 to 15% of our teachers, majors, and captains in the Army had combat patches. And so If you did, you were God. And then now 9/11 happens, and everyone's going to have one. And your biggest fear is this will end, and I'll be that new lieutenant who doesn't have a patch, but all my soldiers do. That's how small thinking it was.
It's all about the combat patch.
It was really important. It still is. It really is. And it's getting important again because my generation, everyone had one. So it was no big deal. But now that we've like downgraded the wars, so it's like mostly special forces who are deploying.
Right.
Like the regular guys who graduated West Point 3 years ago, like they might not have it. And so they feel insecure. Right. Or a lot of them do. That was me. I mean, that's where I was at. And I will say that I went through a little bit of an intellectual education between that point and graduation so that when I graduated in May of 2005, I was not as gung-ho. Mm. I did start to have doubts because I was always, on top of all that like toxic masculinity that I'm describing, there was always a separate side of me that would hide away in like the back of my grandparents' bungalow and read books all day, you know, and like hide that part of myself because it wasn't cool on the, like with my friends. Mm. That side was still there. And so I was starting to read, and believe it or not, during my senior year, Colonel Ty Sedgley, who was a lieutenant colonel history instructor at the time, assigned us in a colloquium class, advanced like history majors, Andrew Basevich's
wow.
The New American Militarism, 2004, wow. I think it published. And this was the spring of 2005 before I graduated. So
anti-war book.
Yeah. Super anti-war book. It shocked my conscience. And if he hadn't been a West Point graduate himself, Basevich, mm-hmm. and if he hadn't been in Vietnam, I would have dismissed this book as liberal garbage. But because he had, it really shocked me and made me think. And so that was just one example. So by the time I graduated, I was still probably pro-war, but skeptical of the outcomes and whether we could win. And so, so that's kind of how I entered the real Army and Iraq a year later. But that's just an idea of where I was at, sort of the conflicted self.
Describe a weekday at West Point. Describe a regular weekday.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I still, my one martial guilty pleasure that still is part of me is that I watch Army football every Saturday.
Yeah.
It's so silly, like in a million ways, but it's like my guilty pleasure. Like I'm allowed, you know. So yeah. I'm this like anti-war guy who hasn't missed an Army football game in like many
years. And you root for Army. I root for Army.
Yeah. And when Army plays Navy, I say horrible things about Navy that are like toxic masculine militarist shit.
Well, that's okay.
It's like my thing. It's like my one thing. So I'll like write an anti-war article in the morning and then I'll be like, those damn Navy guys, they suck because they don't even fight. They go on ships. You know, it's like stupid stuff.
It's okay because guess what my favorite genre of movie is?
Right.
War
right.
movies. My son and I love, we've watched every like special ops movie that's been made. Every movie about a Navy SEAL team we've seen, like
right.
pretty much.
Right. Of course, the best Navy SEAL team scene in the cheesiest movie is the movie Navy SEALs when they have like the bumper cars fight in the golf courts. Like, that's really important to understand. And I'll tell you, I've met enough Navy SEALs to know.
Yeah.
They are like that. Like they're the one group of military folks that live up to their image. They really do look like surfer dudes. They are all muscular and they really do suntan in the middle of combat zones. I can just tell you that from real experience. That's important. These digressions can be important and instructive. But so a typical day, the reason I brought up Army football is if you watch an Army game, especially an Army Navy game, one of the things they do is they always bring up that like screen, like between plays that says a typical day at West Point with like the calendar. Mm-hmm. Cause people are interested in that. Mm-hmm. What is it like? Yeah. It's not like a regular college. It really sucks. I don't recommend it. Keep your kids away. They will not be happy. I mean, it's a tough place. It's not like you don't get beat with the hazing and stuff the way you used to. And they've really tamped down the hazing even since when I was there, although it was still a factor when I was there, but it wasn't like the old days where they would like beat you with cords. Wow. But you do get up, you know, on your typical day, you know, you're up or probably before 6 or around 6. You're kind of, if you're a freshman, which is a plebe where you have very strict standards and you're not really allowed to leave the base, you know, your room gets inspected every day. So you're waking up early to like clean and tidy and tighten your bed. And then you eat breakfast together at maybe, I don't know, I remember the exact time, 7:15 or something. But you know, you eat breakfast, all 4,000 cadets eat breakfast and lunch together every meal. At 10-person family-style tables. And they have this huge staff of wait staff in the mess hall that can serve all 4,000 cadets in and out. Food is served, and they're done, and they're back on their way to business in, like, 22 minutes. It's ridiculous. Wow. It's the length of a sitcom, right, without commercials. And, oh, by the way, that staff is, like, all black, and it's, like, a whole other thing. But nevertheless, you know, so that's sort of – And you go to class then from after breakfast till lunch. There's 4 class periods. You may not have all 4. And then in the hour that you're off, you can go to the library and read, or you can, you know, you go to your room and, you know, you're not really allowed to sleep, but you relax. Then you have lunch together. Same thing. Oh, by the way, there is a formation in your unit because you're broken in, you know, you live in the barracks, but you're organized into companies just like the Army and platoons and squads. And so even though you're a student, and so you march, by the way, to the beating drums. There are active duty sergeants assigned to West Point whose job is to play drum cadence so the cadets can march into the mess hall. This still happens. Anyway, you go to class. There's like 2 more classes after lunch. At 4 o'clock, you do one of 3 things from 4 to 6-ish. You do either some version of military training, like just classes or like practice medical stuff, or you do drill, which is when you put on your dress uniform and practice marching like it's 1802. And oh, by the way, the dress uniform that you always see in the pictures and stuff in the videos, that is the official Army uniform of the War of 1812, because time stopped at West Point. They actually used that uniform. That's what it's modeled after.
Oh, boy. Yeah,
with the feather and the hat and everything. So then you do that, or you play intramural sports. So those are the 3 possible things. Then you have dinner, which except for Thursdays is optional, meaning you can like go eat on your own at the mess hall. It's like a buffet. You don't have to sit with the family style. And then you study, and it's like lights out at, I don't know, it's like 10 or 11, depending on the day. And then you kind of repeat it. And then the weekends might have more military training. And in the summer, there's no class, and you go into the field. You like go live in the woods in like a trailer or a tent, and you just do full-time soldiering. So there's like a very much a dual life. Weekends, you get off when you're an upperclassman. You can go out and like party. And
did you say that technically you're an active member of the yeah. military at that point?
That's right. The only officer cadets, like the only officer candidates who are on active duty are the West Pointers.
Wow.
So you are counted against the numbers. You you not only is the school free, you do get a small salary, but it's more like a stipend. It's a few hundred dollars a month. You actually get paid more than that on paper, but they like take it to like pay for your laundry and your food. Like they just like allot it before you see it, but you are, yeah, you're paid.
Have there been, there must have been, I guess there, I assume there were plebes deployed to war zones, right, in the past?
No, very rare. I mean, even during like the Civil War, they don't graduate the cadets early, really. There have been a few cases. So they, in World War II, World War I, and the Civil War, they graduated people after like 3 years instead of four. But yeah, they don't mess with that. And the reason I think is because the military is a system where it needs a certain number of new officers every year. You know, they do long-term planning, and so they don't want to like throw that off by just graduating all the cadets, you know, because then 2 years from now, who's going to come in? So actually it's very rare. There have been cases of cadets who like were on their summer training, because between your junior and senior year, they send you out to like the real army to practice being a platoon leader for a month. Like you go shadow a lieutenant who then lets you like play lieutenant for a whole month. There have been instances in like the distant past where like a guy was on that training and ended up in the Boxer Rebellion, you know, like fighting. But that's pretty rare, because now they won't send you overseas anymore for that. You only do it in garrison. But yeah, so it's an interesting lifestyle. I mean, and what made the post 9/11 thing interesting is I said we all eat together. It was not uncommon, and it was actually some regularity that you would be sitting there. They always make announcements, like, you know, logistical announcements or administrative announcements before they say take seats, and then you're allowed to eat, because everyone is not allowed to eat till they say you can eat, and then everyone starts eating at once. But during those announcements, moments of silence for dead cadets, like former cadets who died in combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, was with, it was regularity. Sometimes you knew them because they had been in your company, they used to be your squad leader, and now they're dead. And I think what that does is it does add like a sense of like urgency to your life, and makes you feel also very self-righteous and self-important compared to your peers in a civilian college. So it was a strange time. I imagine it was a lot like what it was like to be a cadet during the Vietnam War for like Andy Bates.
Yeah, right. So, 9/11 happens your first month at West Point, right? Or second month?
Yeah, basically my second month, yeah. And yeah, then, I just finished basic training. I got there July 2nd and, yeah, September 11th. So 2 months and 9 days later.
And then the Afghanistan War happens shortly after that. And then the Iraq War happens when you're a junior, right?
Yeah, the spring of my sophomore year.
So you were at West Point when all that's happening, and you have these dead comrades coming back. Right.
And then the new instructors are coming back, right? Because they went to Afghanistan, and then they finished their bit. They get promoted to like, they're a senior captain, and they reply to come back and be teachers at West Point. And so they go to grad school for 2 years, and then they come back like I did. But so my senior year, guys started coming back, captains who had just been in the real war. And they would come back and they'd be like, you don't know how serious this is. Like, you're about to graduate. Let me tell you, son. You know what I mean? It was like really intense. And you wanted to be them. You wanted to be them someday. That's all you cared about.
So all of a sudden, being at West Point becomes really real.
Right away.
Really real. When you're having moments of silence for your dead comrades, right? Apart from yourself, did you see any evidence of real fear among the cadets at that point, you know, during that time? Did anyone, because I would imagine, you know, a lot of them were, you except probably even more naive and silly about it, right? It's sort of like, I'm going to West Point and I'm just going to lead a huge unit of men into war, and I'll have valor and I'll be a national hero, and that's that. And we don't get killed anymore. Americans don't get killed.
Right.
And it's a video game, et cetera. I mean, you're 18-year-olds. I was an 18-year-old boy in this country. We're fucking stupid as shit. I mean, in general. Yeah. I mean, you know, so, and then all of a sudden it becomes really real in that way where, you know, someone you were in class with is dead today, right? Mm-hmm. Did you see anybody kind of crack at all and like betray any fear? Because it must have been fear.
So your senior year, I think it started to come out a little bit more, because now it's really, really real.
Yeah.
And of course, by 2005, the war in Iraq has gone horribly wrong, right? Yeah. The casualties were through the roof. We're losing almost 1,000 American soldiers a year in Iraq, right?
When was Fallujah?
Fallujah is November of 2004.
Yeah, right.
And that April was the uprising in Sadr City, where the 1st Cavalry Division got like really bloodied up.
Yeah.
And a lot of people we knew who had been killed in those incidents. And then by 2005, we're like slipping into chaos. We're in chaos in Iraq. And so it was clear by 04 that this wasn't going to be the Persian Gulf War. We had more casualties in like the first month or month and a half of 2004, more dead Americans than we had in the entire Persian Gulf War, right? So it started to be like, oh God, like this is real and this is going to be prolonged and a lot of us are going to die. So then, but you don't say that in public, and there's a posturing of like masculinity that goes in any organization, especially the military. But when you were with your close friends, mm-hmm. and you've been drinking a lot of times and you are getting close to graduation, yes, there was sharing of like, dude, I'm scared. Like, I'm scared of a lot of things. I'm scared I might die. I'm scared I'll fail and I won't be a good leader and I'm going to get kids killed. I mean, yeah, it got more real as time went on, and then in your private moments with people you trusted. Okay. And there is a brotherhood factor. I mean, the movies overdo that, but it's real. Mm-hmm. And you don't feel comfortable telling anyone but your brothers sort of about that. Mm-hmm. You know? It was scary. And then when you get to your unit and you start doing the really intense training, like go out to the desert in California for a month and like live on your trucks and get ready for the war right before you deploy. Yeah, there's a lot of, there was fear. The casualties were really high back then. We forget now, we've almost forgotten, I think, a lot of people, because now like a handful die a year.
Right.
But like, when I was in Baghdad, we would lose like 60, 70 Americans killed in Baghdad in a month,
In a month.
At the height of the surge. Yeah, I was there for the bloodiest months of the war, and Baghdad was, at that time at least, was the lion's share of the casualties. I mean, it was crazy. I was in Iraq when Andy Basevich's son was killed. Really? Up in Saladin province. And I had read his book in 2005, and I saw his name come. I may have known that his son was dead before Andy did. Because we would follow the reports, like just through our operations center. We would know all the casualties and American casualties and stuff. So, yeah, it was intense.
I would love to have Andrew Basevich on this show to talk about all of this, but especially about his son being killed in battle there. I didn't even know that until recently about him. I just knew him as the sort of well-known anti-war historian and journalist, but that he actually lost a son in combat there is remarkable. And I'd love to hear what you have to say about that. But all right. So you get deployed immediately upon graduating, right? And you go to Afghanistan pretty much. You go to training in California.
And then Iraq first. Yeah.
You went where first?
I went to Iraq first. Yeah. Okay. Which was interesting in a way. So 9/11 happens, it kind of comes from Afghanistan, whatever. And so it makes sense that we're going to go to war there, kind of, right?
Right.
And yet all of us who graduated between like 2003 and 2005, we all went to Iraq.
Right.
Because back then there was only like 15,000 Americans in Afghanistan and there was almost no fighting. In fact, everyone's biggest fear, besides not deploying, which was not a thing, everyone deployed, but everyone's biggest fear was that their unit would be the one that got sent to Afghanistan, because then they wouldn't have as many war stories and they wouldn't feel like they really contributed.
Yeah,
our friends who went to Afghanistan, we would almost be like, oh man, lucky. They're not going to die.
Yeah, hang on a second. I just realized something. So you were at West Point when the whole debate about whether to go to war in Iraq was happening.
That's right.
Right? And so you're at West Point, which is full of basically military intellectuals or intellectuals who specialize in this stuff, right? And my understanding, and this has been corroborated by a lot of people both in and out of the military, is that generally speaking, military people are actually a little bit less on average interested in going to war than civilians, and especially civilian political leaders in particular, right? So what was the conversation like about this, a war of choice, this optional war of George W. Bush on the West Point campus then?
So I definitely got my first skepticism from the Iraq debate, but it wasn't this skepticism I have now. Like, it wasn't that deep-seated, what is the empire doing? Is this a false narrative thing? Right. It was more like, so there was that like chauvinism and militarism and excitement to go to combat among like the 18 to 21 year old cadets. Mm-hmm. And there was even some of that among the captains who were there teaching. But there were enough skeptical voices, colonels, especially the old colonels who'd been in Vietnam. There were still a few left. Bob Doty, serious historian of like the French army, was the head of the history department, and he was a really good friend. I mean, he like endorsed my first book. We were like, I went to his retirement party. Like, I was his like favorite student, we were like close. And he was a class of 65 guy. He graduated with Eric Shinseki. And he was, and he was the oldest colonel in the army when he retired, because the professors at West Point can like stay till mandatory retirement at like age 62 and a half. So like they were the last of the Vietnam guys.
Oh boy.
And what I noticed was those guys were skeptical as hell, and they didn't care. They didn't mind telling their cadets, because they can't really be fired. They're like permanent professors, you know? I mean, they're like, and if you do retire them, what, nothing happens to them, you know? So they were sort of injecting doubt into us, either directly or more indirectly. And that started to like scare me a little, or like shake me a little bit, because these guys who I wanted to be like, you know, you got Bob Doty, who was an advisor with the Vietnamese airborne in Vietnam, badass career, like all the medals you wanted. And then he's like, I remember him saying stuff like calling Eric Shinseki by his first name and being like, well, you know, I mean, Eric is right that if we're going to do this, it's going to take a half a million guys. But I think that where Eric is wrong is that we shouldn't do this in the first place. And oh, by the way, the reason he was class of 65 was because he failed English or something and got left back a year. Like he would just like, but he would like casually place that in French history class, you know, like, which is what I took with him. And so that, I think I saw that doubt. And so no, there wasn't a lot of discussion of like, is the Bush administration evil, neoconservative, you know, using the opportunism, drumming up war on WMD. There wasn't a lot of that, because like liberals, even among the skeptical officers, were seen as like a pejorative, like the L word is bad. But they were skeptical as professional military officers who've seen combat, who've seen this before, this script, who were like, wait a second, this might not be winnable. This might not be in our best interest. We might be getting into, these folks might not know what they're getting this military into. So that was the skepticism at first. It was, can we win? Should we do it? Not, is it venal, evil, imperial? That didn't come till later with my own study and experience. But it was interesting being at West Point, because I will tell you that in 2003 and then in 2004, when it first starts to come apart, I was probably hearing more skepticism from folks in uniform, combat veterans, than you would hear watching MSNBC in 2003.
If I'm the general running West Point, whoever that is, the president of West Point, I assume it's a general.
Superintendent, he's a 3-star general. Yeah.
Superintendent, yeah. So if I'm him, or I'm a United States senator funding the goddamn place, right? Mm-hmm. And my name is John McCain, or pick your senator pretty much during that time, you know, Democrat or Republican. And I really want to go to war against Saddam Hussein, okay? I am not going to allow that. I don't give a fuck about academic freedom. I'm shocked that they let professors at West Point say anything skeptical about a war they're just launching. They're just launching. So do you know about the history of this in Vietnam? I don't know. Like, were West Point instructors cracked down on? There must have been censorship about this stuff during war. They can't allow that among their officer corps.
This is where it gets weird.
It's so weird.
One of the questions I always get is, how in the world did they select you to go back and teach history?
Yeah.
And how in the world did you get away with teaching the things you teach, because they know I taught it because I wrote it in that.
Oh, yeah, because you've taught at West Point.
I taught history.
I taught history at West Point.
Which Basevich did, which H.R. McMaster did, which Bob Doty did. Like, these guys all, like, H.R. McMaster's desk is still in the history department. The desk he used when he taught there in the 90s is still there, and it's considered an honor to be the instructor who gets the office that is H.R. McMaster's desk with like a little plaque on.
Yeah, but he wasn't an anti-war guy like you are.
No, he wasn't. But my point is, like, so there's like all these guys who like become famous who taught there, but like some of them are anti-war. John Gentile taught history there. There is a substratum subculture that runs through the history department. We're known as the hippies, us in the English department. So the other departments don't like us, and it comes out in like intramural scuffles in sports like softball and stuff. But yeah, so that was always there. I will tell you, what I always tell people is you'd be amazed by the academic freedom. I am not someone who's known for like lauding my service or West Point, but I have to be honest. I got away with a lot because there's a lot more academic freedom there than people assume. Hmm. It's imperfect. If you go public and like start publishing stuff, then there will be a pushback. But I didn't really start doing that until towards the end. But remember, but my book did publish. So my Ghost Riders of Baghdad, an anti-war book, right? Yes. But it was hidden as a memoir, sort of. But if you read it, half the book is policy.
Yep.
That published in October 2015 while I was teaching. And the West Point bookstore in the main academic building held a signing for me.
What?
For that book. Yeah.
That's crazy.
It got the sensors because the sensors were so busy. The PAO guys, you have to legally like let them look at it to make sure there's nothing like secret, like no secret data in it. And also that it's not like a polemic against the president, which is against the rules. But when I gave it to them, I gave them a digital copy and a hard copy, like printed out. Hey, this is about to publish. Like I have a publisher. It's going to come out. Can we do the due diligence to cover my ass? They basically said, we're so busy. We don't really have time to look at this. Can you just do us a favor and like, maybe just like send us the stuff you think might be a problem and then we'll let you know if it is or not, which is so ridiculous, right? So then it publishes. No one read it. No one read it or noticed what it was. And then the bookstore was like, oh, wow, one of our instructors published a book. That's pretty rare, especially for one of the young instructors. Like, we want to highlight this. So they had a signing. And so, I mean, I had like my cadets would come and I didn't tell them that I'd written a book and they found out when they would Google me and stuff. But yeah, that went on. But I'll tell you one other thing that'll surprise people. Our superintendent at the time, my last 3 years was a guy named Bill Lennox, William Lennox, 3-star general, Vietnam guy, taught English at West Point along with who? Marty Dempsey, who also taught literature, the chief staff of the Army, Martin Dempsey under Obama. Yeah. So they both taught English,
really,
which is known as the other hippie department.
That's so funny.
Oh yeah, like Marty Dempsey jumps up on top of tables and like performs limericks at parties. He's like the coolest dude ever, actually. Like in his personal life, and he sings like Sinatra. He's a cool dude, actually, and he's known as like a pretty thoughtful guy for the Army. But Lennox invited, I can't remember what year, but it was during the war. It had to be when I was there because it was, you know, that he was only there for 3 years. He invited Chris Hedges to come to West Point and speak to the entire senior class. Okay, it wasn't my senior class, so it must have been the year before me. And Chris Hedges, he'll tell you about it, gave like a speech to West Point's graduating class about why the Iraq War is wrong and a lie and a bad idea. Lennox, the way Chris tells it, Lennox sits in the front row, gets up before the speech and says, I want everyone to listen with an open mind. You might not agree with everything you hear, but it's important to have, we're students and we must learn. And he sits down, doesn't say a word, keeps his arm folded and was like basically smiling at Chris and giving him like nods that he agreed with him. Then he walked Chris across the entire campus, okay, which is a showy thing to do. The superintendent is endorsing in a way. Chris Hedges walks him from the building over to the mess hall to eat together. And the way Chris tells it, he says to him like during the talk, like, during their walk, I agree with like 97% of what you said, even though I can't necessarily say that. And that's why I invited you.
Wow.
I mean,
for those who don't know, Chris Hedges is a very prominent, very left-wing journalist and activist whose positions on politics I disagree with violently on maybe 80% of the issues, but on war, we're totally in lockstep. Total anti-war guy from the start. From the start to the finish. So to have Chris Hedges at West Point giving any kind of speech about anything is incredible to me. But here's the thing, Danny. Do you want to know why they allowed you to teach your anti-war stuff and published your and showed your book, your anti-war book at West Point, and they allowed Chris Hedges to speak there? You want to know why? Because anytime a 15-year-old boy in this country turns on the television, he sees an ad that is so fucking cool for the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. Every time he turns on his PlayStation, he is playing a game most likely that's been co-designed by the U.S. Army, and he's shooting Arabs in the desert, and he's fucking loving it, and this is the thing he likes to do most of all. Anytime he goes on the internet, he is besieged by targeted ads from the Army, the Marine Corps, everything, the Air Force, telling him, showing him that it is super cool looking because it looks like a video game and Dungeons and Dragons and a Marvel movie all rolled into one, and I get to be the superhero, and I get to kill the bad guys. And then on Sunday, he watches the football game with his dad, and the entire thing is sponsored by the U.S. Army, and there's a flyover, and the coaches are wearing camo, and da-da-da-da-da-da, and he gets on an airplane to go for summer vacation. Do I need to go on? And the veterans are allowed to blah, blah, blah.
That's right.
Like, it is the most militarized culture in my lifetime. Now, it's not the most militarized culture in American history, but right. In my lifetime, without a doubt, we are filleting veterans more than ever. And so there is no need for them to worry about your little anti-war punk ass.
And we already, we're already a captive audience. Like, we're already at West Point. So Chris Hedges giving a speech isn't going to stop us from wanting to graduate.
Yeah, what the fuck are you guys going to do?
Even if he injects skepticism.
Yeah, what the hell are you going to do? You're not going to do a damn thing.
I'll tell you this.
Because there's no movement. There's no movement behind you. See, there's no, that's the thing.
Yeah, and
once there's a movement, You would get your head chopped off, though. You're not teaching at West Point, I promise you.
And let's be clear, like, what Lennox was doing was valuable in terms of, like, and, you know, obviously it was valuable to expose his senior graduating class to this, and it was a little bit of a bold move. But I'll be frank. I mean, because I acted this way when I was in the military. It was like a petulant move by a frustrated Vietnam veteran who's about to retire. Like, they're not going to stop me from doing this. I'm going to send a little signal. But it's not going to change anything. I'm pissing in the wind. But I'll tell you what was interesting, what you're describing, and it's still true, or it was still true when I was teaching there from, you know, 2014 to 16. West Point, somehow we got to a place in modern American history where, like, West Point was not actually more, and may have even been less, martial and militaristic and, like, adulating towards militarist culture. The campus of West Point was no more that than, like you described, the airport of the NFL game. And that wasn't true in, like, maybe the 80s, you know? I mean, somehow West Point became more skeptical of at least, like, how we were fighting, maybe not if we were fighting, than society at large, especially at the height of the Iraq lead-up. And that is an obscene reality that needs to be grappled with. And I think someone needs to write a book about that, actually, but, like, about how that inversion occurred. More complication, maybe not full inversion, but it's important. Oh, by the way, Oliver Stone releases Platoon, which wins Best Picture in December of 86. He releases it.
Yep.
And guess what he does in 1987? He's invited by the superintendent of West Point to speak and give an anti-war talk at West Point. I think to the whole Corps of Cadets, he said, but it was at least like one full class of 1,000 cadets. So there is some precedent to this.
Yeah, again, but like during the height of the Reagan Revolution, right? I mean, there was no threat. There was no threat to the military. This is when the military was loving life. You know, they were having a great time under Reagan. So fine, bring your little commie anti-war ass to our campus. It's not going to do anything, right? And it just shows how, you know, how open America is, right? It also helps, you know what you were maybe doing is helping the empire, because you're basically, you're helping them prove that we are about freedom of speech, unlike these dictatorships that we have to overthrow with people like you.
And it's like a tokenism, right? It's like a tokenism of like anti-war free thinking.
Yeah.
That's no threat. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's instructive that Oliver Stone and Chris Hedges were invited in a way. It's like nefarious.
Amazing, but not. Yeah.
Yeah, really it's fascinating. Yeah.
So tell them, because
I will tell you that by 2014, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut off, but by 2014, there were, I would say, I'm going to make a swag here, about 40 instructors in the history department. West Point is one of the biggest in the country. I would say of those 40, I would be comfortable saying that 8 or about 20% were openly against the American, like, war on terror by that point. So that's a pretty large percentage of history instructors at the military academy.
By 2014.
Which is like pretty late in, but it's still kind of surprising in a way to some people. To some people, maybe not as much to you, but to some listeners, or maybe on other podcasts, like a little bit,
I guess,
more like neophyte kind of listeners, when they hear that, they're like, that can't be true. And some people get angry, like, oh, I want to like tell my congressman West Point to hippie fiefdom or something. But yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that's good. And that's really interesting. 20% of West Point instructors are opposing the war on terror in general by 2014, right?
Yeah, in the history department.
Which is the more liberal of the departments.
Yeah.
Yeah, but still, yeah. But I'm trying to think, when did like the top brass, when did top brass people start to be sort of start to throw in the towel on Afghanistan? Like what, 2017, 16? I mean, when they started, you know, when you started to hear from like actual generals being like, yeah, you know what? This has gone on too long. I mean, right. That's pretty, I mean, in the last few years, that's been happening more and more, right? You've had a lot of like big name people.
Well, the Afghanistan papers showed us that, you know, that whole release by the Washington Post, they showed us that as early as like 2009, 10 generals and diplomats were saying that, but privately.
Yeah.
Cause that was all like secret stuff. They were saying that to each other and to like people who were in like the investigative general office.
Right, those motherfuckers. That's 11 years ago. They themselves knew that this was a loser of a war.
And some of the people quoted who were still like, McMillie's one of them, but like some of the people who like said that they were skeptical, this can't be won, it's unwinnable, are still serving now or were still serving late in the war. And if you look at their like, I've seen some work done on this, but I really want to do better work on it and find time. But like, if you take these names that are in the papers and actually go through them and then contrast what they said privately with what they said publicly at the same time or even after, that is obscene. That is criminal. I mean, it is like
criminal.
They're saying stuff like this war can't be won and we don't even have a strategy. And then they're saying there's light at the end of the tunnel to the public. And like, to me, that is actually criminal.
Yeah. That's criminal.
But yeah, by 2017 and 18, you start to see some hesitant, like, doubt publicly from the generals, but you know, it's, you know, 10 years too late.
All right. So you graduate from West Point, you go to the desert in California, do all the scary stuff, getting ready to go to war, get deployed. What unit are you assigned to? Or did you get it? You get to choose a bit, don't you, when you're at West Point? What unit?
Yeah.
What did you do?
Yeah. So you get more of a choice at West Point than the other commissioning sources. Kind of get first dibs because you're like the rich boy officers, you know, you're kind of like the aristocrats and that's the viewpoint, right? So it's based on class rank. It's literally an NFL draft. I mean, you stand in an auditorium and like the first guy gets to walk up and pick his like what job he wants in the army and then like where he wants to be stationed. So if you're like really high in your class, like Mike Pompeo or something, for example, like you're the valedictorian, then you, you know, then you get to pick like whatever, like intelligence in Hawaii or helicopter pilot in Germany. But like then if you're at the end, like most of my friends were, I was pretty high, but like most of my, I rolled with like, I slummed it with my friends. And so my buddy Josh Manuelos, like shout out to Amigo, like he was the last. So I picked armor so infantry and armor are considered like the two main combat branches. Infantry is like even more so, but within the armor branch, there's two jobs. There's like the tank guys. I've never been on a tank. And then there's the recon guys who do like the cavalry stuff, which is basically like glorified infantry, but we wear cowboy hats and are more historically inclined and name our troops after Indian wars we fought.
Like, so armored and reconnaissance. That was the,
So I was not on armored vehicles in my career, but I was technically an armor officer, but I was like sub trained as like a cavalry officer. So instead of horses, it's your feet or like Humvees. Or sometimes Bradleys if you're in the heavier units, but I really didn't serve in those. So I was like a glorified infantry with like a reconnaissance flair. So that was what I picked. There was 130 of us in my class out of like the 900 something who graduated, which is a whole other story that I can get into because we had 911 graduates exactly who graduated in May 2005. But anyway,
wait a second.
So just give you an example of how it works. Like I was pretty high. Like I was like number 9 out of 130. So like when we got to pick our duty station, like I got Fort Carson, Colorado, which is a good one. Like Colorado Springs.
Wait, hold on a second. I think I speak for a lot of listeners when I say, I think I know what reconnaissance is from watching all those war movies, but I'm not exactly sure. Let me see if I know. What exactly is reconnaissance?
So, our soldiers, like their MOS, their military occupational specialty, is called that is 19 Delta is the code, and the term is cavalry scout. So it's scouting. It's the, in a real war, not like the wars I fought, like in a more traditional force on force.
You go look for the Indians.
You go ahead of the infantry and the tanks, and you like find the enemy's armored formations and the fold the gap. Right? That's how we trained. Because we still trained on like Cold War tactics even when the war on terror was going.
Wow.
It started to pivot later in my career or in the middle of my career. But so we would like, you would go like sneak into like observation posts and kind of hide on a hilltop or in the woods. And like you would identify the enemy formations coming and your job was to like count the tanks coming and then do like mental math. Okay, that's like that's a Soviet armored brigade. And then because you saw them coming through that thing, then you can identify from your training that means they're probably doing operational plan Charlie, and that means they're probably doing this. And then your job is to call like artillery or airstrikes on them and then run away before you get caught. But of course, as you always hear, like in the legendary talk of the cavalry, we're so tough. It's like, oh, your life expectancy is actually like 24 minutes. If the real, you know, you're not going to make it back, whatever. A lot of that's like bravado, but so that's the job in a real war. But in Iraq and Afghanistan, we were just infantry. Basically, so that was what Cav did. And
so you weren't doing advanced scouting at all like that in Baghdad?
Not much. I mean, I trained on all that.
All right.
A little bit in Afghanistan because that was a little bit more of like an infantry force on force kind of fight. Okay. So we would leave like, you know, like one of the things we would do, and I mean, infantry units started doing this too, but like we would take over like one of the things we used to do a lot of in Iraq was we would search apartment complexes in Baghdad, like whole streets for weapons. Stupidest mission ever because they don't keep their arms caches in their apartments. But we had a report to the generals, like we searched 1,100 units of Baghdad today, meaning like 1,100 apartments for weapons, and we found nothing, you know. But it was good. But they were still happy. They were like, "Yes, you worked hard today." You know, it's all supply side metrics. That's why we lose wars. Well, that's not why. It's one of the reasons. But yeah, it's really interesting. So what we would do is like, we would take some of our scout training. So we would like make a big show of like searching all these apartments, but we would like roll in with like 20 dudes would go into the apartments block and search it. But then when we'd go back to our trucks at the end of the evening, we would only take 16 back with us, but no one noticed that we left four like in an abandoned like apartment that would like set up like an observation post and then report what they saw all night, or maybe leave a sniper who would like pop a dude when he was trying to put an ID in later. You know, these were the little things we would, so yeah, we would apply some of the tactics. But for the most part, we ended up just being like occupation infantry.
I was going to say, when you said we were, I was just infantry. That means when army people say infantry, what exactly is that category? What does that mean within the army?
Yeah.
Again, I think I know from my movie knowledge, but I'm not actually sure.
Yeah. It's a guy whose like primary job is the trigger puller, the guy who walks from place to place and seizes the hill, right?
Occupies territory.
Yep, seizes and holds territory on his feet. Now, some infantry is armored infantry, and they drive to battle in a Bradley, but right, you know, which is like an armored small tank, but right, it's an infantry carrying vehicle. But okay. But you know, in the end, war has not changed that much, despite all the technology. I mean, of course, it has changed in a million ways, but in the end, and what we learned in Iraq and Afghanistan in particular, is that in the final sense, it always ends up with a dude who is armed not dissimilarly to the guys on Normandy Beach, having to like take a building or like seize under fire an enemy position. I mean, in the end, it ends up there, even after all the drones have dropped their bombs and all the reconnaissance and the footage, and it's all great. But in the end, I mean, that's how it still goes. And also, despite all that technology, in Afghanistan, where we were attacked 365, my troop was attacked 365 days out of 365 day deployment.
We were
attacked every single day. There was not a single day that I didn't have a patrol come under fire.
Whoa.
I would say that a conservative, extraordinarily conservative estimate that is that 95 to 97% of engagements were initiated by the Taliban. So despite all of our ISR, right, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance equipment, despite all of our technology, we couldn't find the ambush team 97% of the time. And they opened fire with what? The ubiquitous AK-47. And that's how it still happens. And so I think that in some ways there is a constancy to like war.
Quite possibly illiterate men with AK-47s in the mountains shooting at you, right?
Like, 9 out of 10 are illiterate. Yeah. 9 out of 10 are illiterate.
Yeah, and winning. Just like the barefoot peasants in Vietnam. Like winning against the greatest military force led by the greatest military minds of all time.
That's right. I just have to tell you, I have to do one like aggression anecdote. One of the things I did, you'll love this, right? Talk about just amazing economics that the military understands. In Afghanistan, we came up with the idea that if we put the people to work, they wouldn't attack us. Reasonable enough. So we would pay them and they'd pretend to work. And then of course they'd pay a kickback to the Taliban. But at one point I had 1,200 Afghans who would line up once a week for payday, and I would pay them to like dig ditches and paint like buildings, just do fake work so that I was putting in work. Yeah, I had the biggest cash for work program. That's what we called it, CFW, cash for work. I had the biggest one in southern Afghanistan for a minute. But so anyway, they would line up, and it was, yeah, I have pictures that I will send you, like of the welfare line. In fact, one of my pictures is called like Danny's personal welfare line. You know, it could be like libertarians would kind of love it, because like there's like so much there about like why it doesn't work to just give stuff away. But
no. Yeah. No, wait, I'm so excited. Hold on. So you know I'm writing this book, right? This whole book, History of Foreign Policy. And it's got several sort of themes in it, but one of the themes is that it became clear to me in doing the research, I did not know this really until I started doing the research, and a few other historians have kind of touched on it, but that beginning with Woodrow Wilson and then through Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Kennedy, Johnson, for sure, the objective in fighting all those wars, World Wars I, II, Korea, Vietnam, the objective for those guys was only primarily to defeat or stop communism. The main overarching objective for all of the, or the bad guys in Germany, the main overarching objective, and they said this, and I've got their receipts in terms of quotes, was we want, as I said about Vietnam, we want to make the Tennessee Valley, we want to make the Mekong Delta into the Tennessee Valley. meaning the Tennessee Valley Authority, which was the centerpiece of the New Deal, which was to say that they wanted to create, recreate the whole world, not just in the image of America, but the New Deal America, progressive America. So when you tell me, I didn't know this, dude, until you just told me this, when you're telling me, and this was a big deal in Vietnam.
Yes.
They would employ, just like you did, they would employ the peasants in these villages to do all this make work stuff. Or sometimes it was like real, just like development projects, you know, digging ditches, right? And with the express purpose of getting them to be on our side instead of the commie Viet Cong side, who were offering them land instead of jobs like we were, right? Now you're telling me that even in Afghanistan, that's going on, right? That
backpacks with hundreds of thousands of dollars.
The welfare
handed over to my second lieutenant who was in charge of it, named Jordan Rich, who would give it out.
Yeah. I mean, you were.
So, the anecdote about like illiteracy, but I think we'll also get to this like whole interesting thing that involves like this, what you're pointing out, which is so important about like Mekong becomes TVA. Well, I made Kandahar into the TVA, right?
Yeah, right.
But of course, even like way less effective, you know, obviously, but they would sign up, they would come up, and like the American bureau, you know, the army runs on paperwork still, like, right? So bureaucracy. So they had a sign for their pay, because somehow if they signed for their pay, that means that I couldn't steal it or they couldn't, you know what I'm saying? Like it was just, but it's stupid, but they had to do it.
Yeah.
But they can't write their names.
Well,
I was in the Appalachia of Afghanistan.
Kandahar. Okay. Kandahar?
Yes. And I wasn't in the city of Kandahar. I was in rural, the Argandab Valley, famous because the Soviets couldn't take it. Like, we were very proud that we, my troop, like, assaulted further south to the Argandab River than the Soviets ever got, right? We were really proud of that. Stupid. It meant nothing. But that's what we took pride in. Like, we are badasses. Like, we're in the most dangerous valley, like, or one of the most dangerous valleys in Afghanistan, right? So I put this into a place. I got a lot of attention because of it. Like generals would come visit. They'd be like, wow, you really have got it. You figured it out, Captain. This, if we could just get every officer to be so forward thinking about you as you putting these people to work. And I'm like, this is bullshit. So how do you know that it's bullshit? Sometimes anecdotes that are funny can be instructive. These people can't sign their name. They don't know how old they are.
Right.
They do not know how old they are. If you ask them to describe how old they are, they describe it like this. I was born in the third decade of the old king's life when there was a full moon in the sky, because that's what their parents told them. And you're like, and then you go back and Google and you're like, I think you're about 79. That's like, and then you tell them and they're like, huh, it's like a great conversation to have with an elder. Anyway, but they can't sign their name. They don't know how old they are. So there was one dude who like, but you have to make them. So some scribble, some do the ink thing, like they voted and they, you know, you make them make their mark, like in the old Western movie, sign your name or make your mark before you sign up for the posse. One guy used to draw a chicken next to his name, a beautiful, tiny little chicken. He was like an artist. It was beautiful. And every week, chicken guy would sign it. But we accepted it. We were like, yep, that's good. That works. And we just like laughed about it. But this is like our lives. But there was another pair. So we paid them and they pretended to work. And of course, the big picture is the Taliban never attacked these big lines of 1,000 people waiting all day to get paid. Now, wouldn't you think that would be the best target for the suicide bombing Taliban folks? The fact that they weren't attacking them, I told my colonel, this means that the workers and the foremen, who we paid more money to like organize it, they are paying a kickback to the Taliban. So the Taliban is profiting directly from what we're doing here. And I said, I'm not necessarily saying we should shut it down. I just think we should be honest about this with ourselves. And he was like, don't ever say that when the generals come. Literally, don't ever say that.
Oh, man.
So anyway, there's that. But so we pretend to make them work. So just to give you an idea of like how like the libertarian mind will love this, like our favorite pair, and I can send you a picture of this, were called Backpack Man and the Ride. Now, Backpack Man and the Ride would line up every week, and they actually did work, I'll tell you. The reason they have the nicknames Backpack Man and the Ride is when the Taliban buries bombs, or we do airstrikes, but it's usually Taliban bombs, people step on them who aren't the intended targets. And so children, old people get killed all the time. It's one of the awful travesties of war. And the area that I patrolled was like the island of misfit toys. I mean, there were like way more people than limbs, you know, or what, you know what I mean? It was like, they didn't add up. So the ride was missing both arms and Backpack Man was missing both legs and one arm. And so I have to send you the picture because it's like a change. It's like life altering, funny, but dark. Backpack Man would ride on the ride with his one arm around his neck on his back, and Backpack Man with no arms would carry him into line, and we would pay them a full salary, just like the other workers, every week. And that's just to give you an idea of, like, that's what America was doing in 2011 when this intellectual, like, you know, refined General McChrystal was going to win the war with coin. Just like to let you know, that's what was happening.
God damn.
Nice guys, by the way. And Backpack Man did pick up a pick and try to, like, he would work and clean out the canal. He worked harder than most of the people with all their limbs who just would pretend. But that was my life.
So we blow off half their limbs, then we combine two of their bodies to make one Afghan worker.
Almost, because they still only have three. Oh no, I guess yeah, they still only have three limbs between them.
And then we pay them welfare to keep them working so that they don't rebel against us.
Which they pay off the top to the Taliban.
And then they give some of that to the Taliban.
So that's why they don't attack their line.
So the Taliban become also welfare queens from the system. So Danny, it sounds like it was working out pretty well.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. It was very
sounds like
it was good economics. It was really good economics. It was very Keynesian.
Just a well thought through operation in general, the Afghanistan war, from beginning to end, I think. Now that it's been how long? 2 centuries?
I wrote an article, just two decades.
Yeah.
I wrote an article for the American Conservative called The Curious Case of Jordan Rich, all about the lieutenant in charge of that program. And it's worth checking out if any listeners just Google it. Like, Kelly really liked it, and it basically tells this story. And I just told his story, and then I didn't even have to really make a political point because it told itself about the absurdity of the surge in Afghanistan.
Yeah, man. But we're going to bring the welfare state to the whole world. It's a progressive cause, Danny. This is what I'm telling you. And by the way, this whole thing about, like, we're going to give them money to do jobs for make work so that they don't rebel against us. I was immediately thought, oh, that's the federal jobs guarantee that's being debated domestically now. It's like they want to, I think that's, yeah, I know that's one of the reasons that liberals would like to give that to people to stop us from rebelling in the streets, right? They give us a federal jobs guarantee. it works not just with the Afghan. It works with Americans too. All right, man. So listen, so you're deployed to Iraq first. You kind of jumped ahead. You were in Afghanistan much later, but you're in Iraq. You're a young guy. You're in your 20s. You're out of West Point. And didn't your mind start to change really fast about the war? You went from gung-ho to gung-no real fast?
Yeah, faster than most. I mean, I think some of that was like, nature as much as nurture. I mean, in a lot of ways, I was not well situated for like the military life. Like, I could posture well, I could run fast, I could lift weights, I could act like them. Yeah. But secretly, I was always like a very sensitive kid, like emotional, cerebral. And so I think weak is what the military would say, right? Mm-hmm. So it may be true in real life too, but I would sort of I would read obsessively, which made me a little skeptical. Like, you know, if I'm going to Iraq, I'm going to read like 50 books about Iraq, like, you know, I mean, literally, I mean, especially when I was there. So I'm learning like the intellectual side that this is problematic, but I think more important initially, the catalyst was the sensitivity. So the country is in the midst of civil war. November 2006, which is the first month that I was like independently patrolling, because I got there in like October 11th, 2006. So
Baghdad.
Baghdad. So yes, south and east Baghdad. And so November 2006 is actually the bloodiest month, as I believe, for Iraqi civilians. So it's the height of the civil war. It's the most bodies in the streets. And what I mean by bodies in the streets is quite literally, you have General Casey, who was the commander of the whole war right before Petraeus. So he's still in command. And you have Rumsfeld and you have President Bush all saying to the press over and over again, this is not a civil war. Do not call it that. They would say that in interviews. But for those of us on the ground, it was quite clear that it was very much a civil sectarian war, because what would happen is neighborhoods would first go to war with themselves. So the mixed neighborhoods, the integrated Sunni Shia neighborhoods, which had lived in peace really for the most part for most of Iraqi history, actually. There's been flare-ups, but it's not this interminable like Manichaean battle.
Right.
They go to war. First, they would cleanse their own neighborhoods. So that would be very bloody. That would usually be the bloodiest in a way. And then it would become just a Shia neighborhood, which would create Sunni refugees or vice versa, who would go to this like other neighborhood nearby. And then the neighborhoods would go to war, like gangs, like Crips and Bloods. And the output of that the black box of the Civil War, the output of that for an American soldier who really patrolled, you know, 8 out of 10 guys stay on the base and don't fight. But those of us who like went out every day and patrolled, is we would pick up the bodies. And so this means like soccer fields were theater. They were political execution theater. So the sociopaths who were empowered by the Civil War and become like militia warlords, many of them were 19 years old, but like wield power, and like all the old men in the streets are like terrified of them. And it's like The Wire, except on crack. You know what I mean? Well, that's an interesting double entendre. But anyway, they would execute people of the other sect and or internal collaborators. And they would leave their bodies tortured, bound, shot in the head, whatever. Sunnis like to cut their heads off if they were Al-Qaeda types. And they would just leave them and you'd find them. But they left them there as theater for like the kids and stuff to see on their soccer fields and everything. So it was really gruesome. And I think, but I did actually end up, usually it was like hours after they'd been killed. But early on, it was my first independent patrol. I came up like literally minutes, not even like, I don't know, 90 seconds or something after an execution, after a Shia Mahdi army, Maqtada al-Sadr's crew, one group of teenage Shia warlord types, Mad Max style, rolled up on two Sunni teenagers who were selling bootleg gasoline, black market gasoline on the side of the road, and popped out, pulled their pistols, and just, you know, gangland execution. Shot this one guy in the head, his brains were all over the pavement, and then shot this other guy in the chest at least once in a couple other places. And so we like responded. We heard the gunshots, and we like, here comes the cavalry, and we like zoomed to the sound of the guns, right? And it was my first independent patrol. I had never really like seen someone's, like a teenager's brains on the floor yet. Maybe that shouldn't have been so viscerally like affecting, but I think because I'd been reading and because this day, like what that day was, like what I did that day was so different from like war in the traditional sense. No, by the way, like we got hit with an IED that like separately, like I think it was on the way back. And then it's so hazy, but we were hit with an IED, but like nothing happened. Like our armor held up. But in other words, like, so you got these two warring sides killing each other in front of us. We're picking up the pieces. We actually took one of them in the back of my truck, laying across the back of my truck to our hospital on base, which wasn't allowed. But I said, fuck it, I'm coming in. Like, I'm not going to let this guy die. The hospitals weren't working. The whole system had come apart in the wake of the invasion. It's 3 years after, and the hospitals are still not operating. Mm. And oh, by the way, there were Sunni and Shia hospitals by this point. And if you go to the wrong hospital, you can be executed, because what they do is they wait for you to be discharged, and they would execute you on the way out the door. So a lot of people didn't go to hospitals, kind of like gang members do in the States sometimes. Like, mafia guys have their own doctors. The militias had their own doctors. Jeez. So you didn't have to go to a hospital. It was Mad Max. I mean, it was dystopian. And I have to listen to these folks say that there's no civil war. But more than that, that came later, the anger, but was like, what have I done? What are we part of here? You know, I knew enough about Iraqi history to know it hadn't always been this way. And then I got people telling me that I respect, while I drank tea with them in their living rooms and they share the only food they have. They're saying, these are Shia people who hate Saddam more than anything, saying, it was a lot better when Saddam was here. You guys really screwed this up. And that's hard for like a sensitive 23-year-old kid here, you know? And mm-hmm. So yeah, that guy died in the back of my truck. I mean, he like death rattled, you know, like real shit. Like, and then somewhere in there, we got attacked with an IED. And so like, now I know they're not only killing each other, they're trying to kill us. So we're in the middle of this whole thing that we started. And then, oh, by the way, I go back to the like neighborhood where these two teenagers were killed to like, cause we just took this like wounded teenager away without telling anybody, you know what I mean? Like, and so we go back down there. I thought it was the right thing to do to like go like try to find his family or whatever, find the father who's like this bearded old dude, and it turns out they were both his sons. They were brothers or cousins, but no, they were brothers because they were both his kids. And then like he's crying and I'm 23, and then he's not even mad at me, and he's like, it was just, and then he invites me to tea. So that was my day. That was my first independent patrol. And then that sounds theatric, but it was not as atypical as one might think. And because my buddies had a lot of similar stories, you know, and maybe it wasn't their first patrol, maybe it was their fourth, but that was the experience. And so for me, it was like, maybe I wasn't ready to like turn on the empire at that point, but I was ready to be like, what we were told this is, seems so obvious, but took me that long, is not what I'm doing. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it was really, it was arresting. It was a very, and it got worse after that. And then my kids started getting killed, you know, and between December 14th of 2006, when Sergeant Ty DeJane was shot in the spine, he's still in a wheelchair, between the, I mean, I'm not trying to say I had like Normandy level casualties, but just this was high for Iraq at the time. Probably maybe partly a reflection of my poor leadership and not keeping people alive. I don't know. But from December 14th, 2006 until between then and say, I mean, the dates are all in my head, but around March 1st, I had a platoon of 19 to start with because scouts have smaller platoons. I had eight killed, wounded, bad enough to be sent home. Eight have been killed, wounded, bad enough, you know, and some other small injuries. So, you know, we're talking like close to 50% casualty rates. Yeah. Three dead, one killed himself on leave, my driver. So, in other words, you take what I saw in that early patrol, this whole thing is a mess, and then your own kids start getting killed, and the output is like, it broke me. I mean, it broke me. Right? I wasn't tough enough. I mean, I stayed in the Army and went to another war, and I had great glowing evaluations, but secretly, I was...
So you had 19 men in your unit and three of them died?
Yeah, three died. Five were sent home with bad injuries. One was paralyzed. Yeah, paralyzed. And then there were some smaller injuries. Yeah.
Yeah. In like a four-month period?
Yeah. I mean, I was there for 15 months, but all of that happened between December 14th and about March 1st. But most of that happened on December 14th, January 20th, and January 25th. Those were the three big days for casualties for us. I mean, I remember them. I mean, like, you know, like it says on my, this wristband, like January 25th, 2007, you know what I mean? So, I mean, I celebrate that like it's a holiday almost. Like it's like, there are people in my life who send me a text and say, I'm thinking about you today. You know, like my ex-wife, mm-hmm. you know, because and that was when Alex and, you know, Michael were killed in a bomb. And my son who's in the room, I'm looking at the room he's in right now, is named, you know, Alexander James Michael. We call him AJ. He's got three names, though, and he's named after the three guys who died in my platoon in Iraq, one of whom killed himself, James, mm-hmm. on the heels of his best friend, Alex.
Yeah, you should not be a sensitive person if you have that job, man.
I really should have been like I should have, like, sat around and, like, just read all day or something and been a monk, I think, but instead I decided to prove I was a real man.
I'm another sensitive pussy man, and I can't imagine. Can't imagine that, going through that. I can't imagine any part of that story, seeing the kid die, seeing people getting killed, but then having people in your on your team, who I'm sure you were very close to, get killed under your command. I suppose having a child die has got to be the only thing worse, maybe. That's got to be right up there, man. And you were how old then? 20 something, 3, 4, 5?
I was 23. Yeah,
23.
23. Yeah, I turned 24 that August after all those deaths.
What was your rank then?
Second lieutenant, and well, no, I made first lieutenant on November 28th of 06. So yeah, I was a brand new first lieutenant.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was wild. It was wild, but it was like it wasn't just like me or anything. Like it was my whole like generation of people who graduated from the academy and stuff around the same time as me.
Oh yeah.
We were all in Iraq together. Yeah. I saw buddies in Iraq in different units in like meet cutes. Like I was going on leave halfway through, you know, you get to go home for like 2 weeks, which is like a whole other thing. But like I'm at Baghdad airport, like waiting, like in a queue to go home. And it's like a mess. And there was like a bad system. And my buddy, Tyler Stegman, who I like graduated with and was like a buddy I used to party and drink with, and he played rugby and he was this muscle bound dude, and he's there and I haven't seen him in like a year and a half, and he's like, what's up, dude? And I was like, hey man, how's it going? And he's like, oh, this place is a fucking mess, huh? And I was like, yeah, this is crazy. And he's like, hey, you want to see my shoulder? And he's like, he had just gotten like grenade shrapnel in his shoulder, like, you know. And it was just like, it was but that was like my college life, like those were like my frat boy buddies, but we're like meeting up in Baghdad, like it was just bizarre. It was a whole generation of officers who just got sucked into this war that really sucked up the whole army. You were either in Iraq or you were getting ready to go to Iraq in 2006 and 7 and 8.
I love the love in a very bitter way. The idea of the Vietnam generation training the Iraq generation, right? The two, totally. Like two wars that it's now essentially a consensus among the mainstream, among normies, among PBS and Fox News, that they were bad wars, very bad, dumb, stupid, wrong wars, right? And that's all we've got. Like in terms of people who have been in combat, basically we have a handful of Korea and World War II vets left, but not hardly any. But basically we've got like two generations of guys who fought in wars that everyone agrees should not have been fought.
That's an interesting point. I want. I'm gonna tell you right now that I'm gonna like have to footnote you. But this Veterans Day, I'm gonna write an article now. Like I'm literally gonna write it about how we're getting to the point, or we're kind of already there, where maybe, arguably, for the first time in American history, or one of the first times in American history, all the living vets are veterans of like unethical and unstrategic.
Well, I mean, some of us think that all the wars were those.
Veterans. Right. No, and I don't totally disagree with that. But yeah. But it's like a very like obvious mainstream.
Yes. Yeah. This is like everybody. Ken Burns and. Mm-hmm. Everybody but John McCain, basically, pretty much. I mean, Republicans and, you know, we're saying, yes, Afghanistan and Iraq and Vietnam, not such good ideas. And we should get out, yeah. Right? Totally. And that's it. That's who trained you is the Vietnam generation. And then you guys became the Iraq generation. So I'm just thinking about, like, the cultural effects of that. I would have to think that within the military, there's got to be a pretty deep cynicism verging on nihilism. If you've got that as your heritage, right? So as opposed to the knuckleheads who went flying into Vietnam as fast as they could because they were of what generation? The World War II generation, the badasses. They had just crushed the biggest, scariest, so it was said, regime ever, and they did the world the greatest service ever in human history, and we were the all-time champions of everything, and that's one of the main reasons we all agree that we went into Vietnam because of their hubris. And so it's a very good thing that the United States lost the Vietnam War because, for one thing, we haven't had a draft since then, and everyone with a brain knows it's because of Vietnam, because of the opposition to it, because of the failure of that war. But there was also this crisis of authority that a lot of historians, and I'm sure you know about, that we talk about, right? The crisis of liberalism, but authority generally, like by the early 1970s, that government institutions, even scientists who invented all the bombs that we dropped on those poor people, right, in Asia, beginning with Japan, right? But Vietnam was really the reason that a lot of the American left had that kind of countercultural, broad-based kind of distrust of authority, which it no longer has, right? Now it actually is looking for authority all the time. Mm-hmm. Right. And the pandemic is just the latest example. It's like, what are the doctors saying? What are the government doctors saying? What is the government saying? What does the governor say? But back in the 60s and 70s, the left was looking around at, first of all, this war that was obviously absurd in the most horrific ways. It was looking at segregation laws that were obviously irrational and racist, which is by definition irrational superstition. We knew by then, you know. So it's like, I'm hoping that actually in the military, there's a cynicism about these institutions. It might, I want a cynicism about the big institutions. Okay. And in some weird ways, like I see a healthy cynicism maybe in the ranks of the military more than in the civilian population. Does that make any sense?
Well, we do know that 73% in the latest poll of veterans of the war in Afghanistan support full withdrawal. 73%. And I think that's a Koch brothers poll even. I mean, but there's more than one, so it's not like a singular poll. Like they all hover between like 60 and the highest 73% in more recent polls, which is higher than the civilian population.
Wow.
Which I think is one of the first times, if not the first time in American history, where there's that much of a gap where the veterans are more against the war than the soldiers. Because even at the end of Vietnam, it would have been close maybe, but this is pretty obscene. Like this is pretty big disparity.
Wow.
But I will say that there's a block, and it really is that draft. And I don't mean to make everything about draft, and I'm not even hyper excited about the draft. I mean, it sounds like I am if you read my articles, but I think people miss the nuance. But here's what I'll say, and I think I've never laid it out like this before. There's three ism responses for soldiers to like what I saw, and I'm going to tell you what my I'm going to give you a swag and listeners of what my West Point officer people have. These numbers are probably different for enlisted. I'm going to be careful about making the swag. And they're definitely different for generals because they didn't mostly fight. They mostly were like at high levels when these wars were going on. But so you see what I saw, which most of my buddies did. And there's like three responses to that. So I'd say by this point, by the time I'm in the wars and we're in Iraq and Afghanistan, so say when most of us are done with our multiple tours, like 2012, 13, when things start to slow a little in both wars, the response to what I'm describing, this like horror and absurdism among the graduates that I know, is about 30% went to chauvinism. Hmm. Screw these Arabs, screw these Afghans. They're monsters. They're animals. Mm-hmm. Like I hate them for killing my soldiers. But it's actually less than people would assume.
Okay.
In my, this is also based on my anecdotal experience, but it's a decent survey size. 60% go to nihilism. Mm-hmm. It's like, I don't believe in any of this anymore. It doesn't matter. Like, I'm just going to focus on my little world and my family or my alcohol or a little bit of both. And like, just go on. And like, no one talks about victory anymore. Mm-hmm. People, my buddies who are still in the army would, and even the more conservative ones, would laugh at you or anyone if you said to them, so like, what do you think? You think like, our strategy is good? Like, we're going to win this thing? They would laugh because they don't care. They've given up on that. They're almost like nurses. They see themselves as like mercenaries in a Praetorian Guard. It's a job. It's a profession. Sometimes it's a family profession because their dad was in it. And then about 10% go to like what I'll call activism. And that's actually too high. But I'm just trying to keep even numbers. Like about 10% go to some version of like, I'm against this and I might say something about it.
How do we kill this fucking zombie? That's what it is. It's not an endless war. I didn't like when Jeremy Scahill came out with that formulation because that's pessimistic nihilism that I don't like. It tells you don't even bother trying to end the war. Mm. But it is definitely a zombie war because you have a majority of the people fighting it thinking it's a waste of time. Okay.
That's what I called it in my latest anti-war column on Tuesday. I called it the zombie war in Afghanistan.
Oh, did you? Yeah. It's so most of the people fighting it, even calling the shots, think it's a waste of time. There's a near consensus within the mainstream media that it's a waste, that it's a bad war on the right and the left. 90% plus probably of the civilian population is essentially unaware that it's going on.
I don't care.
Like, yeah. I think it's deeper. I think I would bet you that at least 3/4 of the American population do not know that we are actually fighting in Afghanistan right now. I would bet you it's that deep, the ignorance, but it's certainly very deep. Americans don't care or don't know in a very deep way. And yet it just keeps chugging along. Now, Trump might finally pull them out, but my God, it's just like, it's incredible. I can't quite explain it except
we're through the looking glass, Alice.
Yeah. But let's back away from let's do the theory in a second.
So
you change your mind almost as soon as you get there, as soon as you see what war is really like, you're young. And then you spend the next, however many years, more than a decade doing this thing.
That's an ethical failure, by the way, just
rising. I don't think so. Rising in ranks, getting up very high in the army while your commitment to anti-war and anti-empire deepens. And so by the time you're leaving the army in 19.
Yeah, yeah.
You're a full-fledged commie faggot, basically.
Yes, totally.
And the people in Staten Island are disowning you. Your family does not like you at all for this reason.
Someone won't talk to me.
And so part of it was that you were a sensitive guy like me, and I couldn't have hacked it at all. Part of it was that you were a reader, that you had been reading, and I guess you'd read Basevich's book by then or anything by him?
Yeah, I had read Basevich's book while I was, like I said, it was assigned to me.
At West Point.
But then I read all of his books during, I did have some like seemingly like theatrical or fictional things where like I would be in Iraq and like I would go on patrol and like we would kill people and then I would come back to like my little bunker we lived in and I would be reading like, whatever book was out at the time, like The Limits of Power by Basevich. Yeah. I mean, it was bizarre like that. You know what I mean?
Oh.
The dual life.
Oh,
In Iraq, like reading and like Chomsky and, but not just like lefty stuff, but like just, I'm reading like the history of Iraq since 1400. And then I'm also reading these like anti-war polemics and Chalmers Johnson while I'm in the wars that he's talking about predicting and all this.
So you killed people.
Well, I mean, I will tell you, I'm not a good enough shot with my rifle, and nor is that the main role. I don't think I've killed anyone with my rifle. I've suppressed the shit out of people, though, as I used to joke with my soldiers, and they'd be like, sir, like, if you're shooting, we're in trouble. Like, get on the horn and call the airstrike. But, oh, yeah, certainly. That was like, I mean, the killing that I did was with a radio. It's the most lethal weapon in the American Army. And,
radio in airstrikes.
I would call airstrikes. I called hundreds of airstrikes, drone strikes.
Bomb this building. Right.
Apache helicopters, F-16. One time a Marine Corps colonel who was flying an F-16 dropped a like several hundred pound GBU guided bomb unit. He put the wrong coordinates in when he switched from military grid system to lat longitude, which is what the Air Force, like what the planes use. And he put the position of our base in, like the caller, and dropped a bomb in the middle of our base. And like, I thought all my guys were dead, but luckily the bomb went too far into the ground and so when it exploded, it only killed three of our Afghan soldier allies, which it threw out of the base during the ambush. And then like my guys had to go out on patrol and like recover their bodies. And then wouldn't you know, the Afghan army was like a little distrustful of us after that. They were like, you know, didn't really help with the trust. I mean, you can't make these stories up. I mean, it was not that abnormal. We laugh about it. We have a reunion every year, my lieutenants and I, like the officers of my unit, I'm going to Jordan's wedding in a little bit. Someone is going to, when we're a few in, is going to tell the story of when like Jordan called the airstrike and the Marine colonel put in the wrong coordinates and how funny it was that Sergeant Rasmussen ended up at like the bottom of the hole and had to like dig in it to find his rifle because he knew he'd be in more trouble for losing his rifle than for the colonel dropping the bomb on us and like going out and getting the Afghan bodies. Like we have these like dark laughing fits in the belly about it. But that was the war.
And three people died in that.
Yeah, three human beings who were like on our side, you know, sort of like,
right.
Yeah, and it was like, I mean, that's what happened. But I mean, I'm not even mad at the colonel. Like, people make mistakes. Like, that's the other thing.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah.
It's a mess. It's a mess. But yeah, I mean, I wasn't like some like badass fucking, like, I wasn't like wiping people out with like my bayonet or anything. I was an officer who called a lot of airstrikes and killed some folks and some people who didn't deserve it, frankly. Yeah. I don't even really want to go into that. Like, it's like a whole thing. Like, I mean... Yeah.
What do you mean?
I've been responsible for strikes that kill people who were civilians. I mean, you know, you're careful. You think you're careful. You think you're good at your job. You hit a corner apartment building with an Apache Hellfire missile because there's a sniper in it, and you think you're doing the right thing, and then you know, it collapses. Right? Like one apartment. You know, who's responsible for that? Is the pilot? No, the guy who called it like is more responsible, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, so you just look, you know, you live with that. And it's not like I was some victim who like did a me lie or something, or not that person would be a victim, but I'm not like trying to overplay like the woe is me, like sensitive soldier. But you know, you do deal with that. You're the guy with the radio. You're the guy who's responsible for planning the mission. And so when your guys die or you kill others, there's certainly that component of like guilt, responsibility. And, you know, I think that most of us, I know most Americans don't really think about that. Like, don't think about the fact that, like, you know, even forget about the ones we killed directly, but like, more Iraqis were killed in the streets in the Civil War of November 2006 than died on 9/11. And like, I don't think most Americans really care about that. You know, I mean, forget about the 85,000 starved to death Yemeni children, et cetera. Like, but I don't think we grapple with that. I don't think we even have enough. I think there's like an empathy gap. We have like empathy ADHD too. I don't even think we care. We don't, and I'm talking polite liberals don't really care. Like Park Slope liberals who like will tell you how bad Trump is and that they're like, they're citizens of the world. I'm not, I don't believe in countries. I'm a citizen of the world. No, they don't care. They do not care about refugees, Palestinians or Iraqis or whatever.
So last I checked, the left cared more about one demographic than any other in the world times 10, which is poor black people. Last time I checked. Poor black people is what the left cared about more than anything in the whole wide world. As we're speaking, as you know, the United States is killing the poorest black people on the planet in Yemen and Somalia. Right. And during all these protests over the last many, many weeks, much of which I fully supported when it was against police brutality and state violence. You may have noticed that they imported every left-wing cause there is into those protests, except I haven't seen it.
Anti-war.
Except for anti-war. I haven't seen it yet. While we're killing, I thought Black Lives Mattered, guys. While we're killing black lives in Yemen and Somalia all the time.
I mean, it's
pathetic.
I wrote in a Tom Dispatch article, and I thought about not writing it. I wrote something like, because like the anti-war veteran organizations I'm a part of, especially About Face and Veterans for Peace, which are pretty lefty, we not only like we're not heroes or something, but as soon as this hit the streets, as soon as George Floyd took on, like within a week, we were active, and we shifted almost all of our effort to like Veterans for Black Lives campaign, like a sub campaign. And we were in the streets every day. I mean, people were in it more than me, but the first month I was in Kansas City, 27 out of 30 days, commuting to protests, and like went to Tulsa, got kicked out of the rally. Some of us got arrested. Like, and I wrote in this Tom Dispatch article about military dissent, which about how it's rising. I said, you know, we stood up for these folks, and like, it's the right thing to do no matter what. And you should do things about the expectation of reward and all that yada, yada, humanist stuff that I believe in. But I said, like, I have my doubts at night when I'm feeling petty, but it's not petty, that when it's our turn and we decide on a big campaign to get us out of the next war or get us out of Afghanistan, we are not going to get that support from the BLM community or any of these other causes. They're not going to be there for us.
Yeah. I was going to say, unless a Republican's doing it, but a Republican is doing it and they're still not protesting. They're still not. Trump, the worst human being ever in history, times 10, apparently, is doing it. And they're still not concerned about it. Donald Trump is killing poor black people and they don't care about it.
No. Yeah. In Somalia, the casualties are up like an enormous amount. I mean, I wrote a piece about it that even got into Somali media like a couple of months ago about how, you know, our casualties are up and our strikes are up like 1200% in some cases. And it's not even news. Find it in the New York Times.
Have you have you written a piece like directly attacking these protests for this? You should.
No, I haven't. I haven't gone there. It was in a concluding paragraph of a broader article where I said, like, I soft pedaled it, to be frank. I mean, I was weak. It was some weak sauce stuff, but I basically said, like, I have my suspicions, but it was kind of passive aggressive.
Maybe I'll do
it. But I think that I will have to write an article about, like, I don't know what I would call it. It would be something like, you know, intersectionality inverted or something, or nice. Like intersectional in name only or something.
Nice.
Because everyone talks about that phrase. And like, all I'm saying is that About Face and Veterans Peace, I'm not speaking for these organizations. I'm speaking for myself and what I've seen. Okay. Because I have been asked to do spokesperson work and I've got to be very careful. But like, it is factually and empirically true. But if you just go on their websites and their Twitter feeds, that they have stood up and really made this the focus, the members have. And like, we are intersectional. Like, we live what they, you know, they're all, that word is so popular now. And like, I'm like, whatever about it. Like, it's good. It's important. I understand. I'm not minimizing it, but I think sometimes these like buzzwords become more powerful than the meaning, but, or they become more fake. But like, I'm just saying, like, we are intersectional. We live that. And I just don't see it happening in the absence of a draft, in the absence of like serious corporate media reporting on these wars. We're not going to see people in the streets for the next lead up to war or to end the ones that are going on, or for Yemeni children or for Somali children or for African Sahel children from the countries in some cases where the slaves were taken to the coast and brought to the Americas, who are now, you know, the police are, you know, suppressing. I mean, there's just like no sense of that, like that Black Lives Matter, all lives matter, whatever you believe. If human lives matter, then when the empire kills and then sends the veterans, the broken veterans of those wars, into the police departments at higher rates than ever, where they shoot people in the streets and use their weapons three times as many as anybody else. This is all connected, and we don't talk about it, because if we talk about it, it's only in the interest of how it affects the communities that we're rallying for now, not how it affects the victims overseas. Like, that's absent. No talk of that.
Now, I will say it is hard to care a lot for people you never meet. And in fact, I think in a way we shouldn't care. And, you know, it's sort of it's the caring about these people in foreign lands that has gotten us into all these wars, right? That's how every war started, as you know, as a historian. Every right. single war started with some intellectual, and it was always an intellectual, saying, there's this country over there where there's bad people doing bad things to poor victim people. And we need to go every damn war from the Civil War on, right?
Was yeah, just the Cubans and the Spanish American War.
Everyone, right? Everybody, there's
Cuban lives matter, right?
Cuban lives matter, yeah.
Independence. Not really.
Anyway, we need to deal with that. Oh, so I was gonna say, so it's easy. So in a way, we shouldn't care too much about what other people are doing in the rest of the world. But I suppose once we are there, and especially someone like you in person, it might be a good idea to like get to know what's going on in their minds a little bit. Now you stand apart in this way too, among veterans, people who served, as far as I know, people who served in Iraq, and even among like anti-war veterans. You developed a pretty close, didn't you, sort of a relationship with an Iraqi?
That's interesting, because I think what it will help to describe is like, there's always like a back, there's always like a, like an epilogue to these wars, you know, like once the American combat divisions leave, we sort of forget, but I got first really close to my interpreter, and in the end, I actually developed a pretty strong affinity for like the Arab people and the Iraqis. I know how like goofy liberal that sounds, but I mean, I just found most of them to be decent, just like all humans, not because they're Arabs, because they're humans. You know, like most of them aren't sociopaths. Most of them aren't killing us or each other. But yeah. Akil Ali Jassim is from Sadr City, from a very poor family. Like Sadr City is like, it makes American ghettos look like, you know, country clubs. I mean, it's 2-3 million people in an area the size of like,
it's like,
you know, Bushwick and Williamsburg combined. It's not a big area.
It's like the famous Shia slum of Baghdad, where a lot of the fighting happened and where you were.
I was like right on the southwest corner, and it was a mess. But he's from there, and I didn't even know his name for like the longest time, his real name, because all our interpreters had code names for a lot of reasons. So they would give themselves a name. Most of them would give themselves like badass names, because these like the people who chose to be interpreters a lot of times were like really had an affinity for Western culture. They were kind of like Arab frat boys, you know what I mean? They weren't religious. A lot of them were like atheists, and they would have like cell phones with porno on them, like not what you think of as like typical. Like a conservative Islam. So they would give themselves names like Safe, you know, which is like sword, or like Assad, lion, or whatever, like, or sometimes they just give themselves like American names, like badass stuff. But then I had Mark, you know, that's what he called himself. And I'm like, oh my God, like the first gospel that was written, like the least, anyway,
started on like the least badass stuff. Name there is.
Like I established it as like, oh, this, like I was meant to meet him. But what I found out early on when he was assigned to me, I don't know. We just started talking, and his English was excellent. And it turned out he had 2 master's degrees, one in English. I mean, he basically had like 2 master's degrees in like, I guess like American and German studies. So it was like language plus history, culture, you know, like what we'd call the studies department. So he had like 2 master's degrees from Baghdad University. But of course he had like, you know, no job. There wasn't much to do with it. There was lots of education in a society that like Iraq that was quasi socialist, but not a lot of jobs. So he was like overeducated. And then, you know, he was excited about Saddam being gone. He's from the Shia underclass. And the Americans come in, he had high hopes. And also, it was a really, really good paying job. Really, really good paying, like $2,200 a month or something at the time, which in Iraq was an enormous amount of money. And so he kind of believed, and then he did it for the money. And he developed an affinity for the Americans, even though he found us to be pretty, like, coarse and just, like obtuse and stuff. But but he did like us, and so he worked with the American Army for a total of 7 years. But I worked with him in his 3rd through 4th year working with the American Army. And what I found out on like our first patrol, I don't even remember how it came up. I think I say, I may tell him where I agree in the book, but like for some reason we ended up, and I cannot even remember because I can't tell you right now how it could have come up, but somehow we both found out that we had read Bernard Lewis books, like, you know, the kind
of
like
the Clash like, of Civilizations book.
Yeah, Clash of Civilizations, like kind of like wrote a lot about Islam, but he's kind of problematic, or he's like controversial because he was like kind of on board with like the war.
The argument, I mean, the argument as I understand it is that the clash between Islam in the East and Western civilization was inevitable, right?
Right. So like that's Samuel Huntington is the one who like wrote that article and that book, and Bernard Lewis was sort of a proponent and also one of his like intellectual motive, like muses for that. And so he's in that, and these guys, like this group of intellectuals, were like the small percentage but significant that supported Bush in the war. But he is a scholar, right? And he wrote tons of books, and a lot of his early stuff was more important. He wrote a lot about like the Jews and Islam and stuff. But so like we found out we both had read like a bunch of Bernard Lewis books, like, and this is like an Iraqi. And then we just kept talking. And my crew, James and Alex, who both end up dying, but like this is early in the deployment, they would make fun of us all the time. They'd be like, oh God, like the Sir and Mark are just going to talk about dorky bullshit this whole ride. Fuck. Like, I mean, that was like, but we were like buddies, me and him. And like, we were like kindred spirits. And he was like a soft, sensitive dude. And he would teach me. I mean, I learned so much about Iraq from him because he would tell me what to look for that I wouldn't otherwise see. You know what I mean? He'd be like, oh, like see the clothing he's wearing, that means that. You see all these like flags hanging, what does that mean? So he was just like this really fascinating guy. We both read a lot. And then he wasn't like assigned to be just my interpreter. We had a rotation system at the time, but I knew how to game the system. So the way I worked it out was basically for the rest of the year, he was always my interpreter, like almost always. I was really upset if I didn't have him. And you know, he taught me Arabic. Like I learned pretty decent Baghdad, lost most of it. I learned pretty decent Baghdad dialect. Arabic, he would teach me in like 4th grade school books that he would like take from like his like little brothers and stuff. Now, by the way, one of those little brothers who was a kid then later, and I'll get to this in a minute, but like later on becomes a member of the militia that fights ISIS, but I'll table that for a second. So that's Akil, and he's a kindred spirit. He actually taught me to be really warm and kind to the Iraqis, and he like always was like injecting empathy into me. Like even when I would get like angry at them for like not telling us who buried the bomb, he'd be like, but like you gotta understand, like they gotta live here and all that. And he was just like this voice of reason, and he was super cerebral and not like the other interpreters. We all made fun of him because he was actually religious, right? This whole idea that like being religious is bad in Islam, like there's this like an idea of like American thing, like, and don't get me wrong, like I'm not really like a religion guy, and I'm certainly not like a fanatic religion guy, but like, you know, he was like a conservative guy. Like he was like a virgin and like, you know what I mean? He didn't drink alcohol, but he wasn't like Al-Qaeda type at all, you know? And so anyway, that was him. And eventually, so he worked with like three units after I left, you know, their life was bizarre. And by the way, interpreters were getting murdered all the time. Bob, one of our interpreters for our unit, was very popular. His codename Bob, I don't even know his real name. He was like executed down in this Al-Farniyeh neighborhood off duty, and like, they held him hostage and like called in a ransom first, but ended up executing him anyway. And it was a very dangerous job. I mean, they had to like check under their cars, like prison guards, you know, during the IRA period in like Britain. I mean, it was a tough life. Eventually he gets to the States. I had a tiny part in that. I wrote a letter to Senator Hillary Clinton in New York, like a long, like stream of consciousness, like bizarre letter that was like all emotion and no facts, like about why we need to get Akil back to the United States and all he's given, you know. And I never received anything back or whatever. But eventually, years later, he gets his like visa and gets to the United States. Of course, not until he takes all the money he had saved, most of which he had been given to his family anyway, but what he had saved, he gives to his brother, who had just gotten married, not the same guy, older brother, to buy a house in like a decent neighborhood outside of Sadr City. So he comes to the United States without like a dime in his pocket, right? And he comes to the United States, and the State Department settles him in Raleigh, North Carolina, which for some reason was like a hub for like people coming on the interpreter visa program. Mm. And he drives a cab despite his two master's degrees. And then a few years later, that wasn't not a very good job. He wasn't really making a lot of money. He didn't like Raleigh and could only afford like kind of crappy apartments. And his like apartment would get broken into. He lived in like the ghetto, like his like TV would get stolen. It was awful, you know, like the life of these interpreters when they come. But now my mom got him a job driving a truck. He's a teamster for the New York Blood Center. He drives blood around New York. He lives in Astoria, Queens. He still goes back to Sadr City where his family mostly still lives. Some have moved out, like the brother that he bought the house for. Or I think it was actually his sister and his brother-in-law, but he could correct. Yeah, we can talk to him sometime, maybe, you know. But the interesting thing is, so Akil's family is still there, and like the American army pretty much leaves when he leaves, you know, because he gets to the States around 2011, which is like when Obama abandons Iraq, right, or all this. And so, you know, the American combat brigades are home, right? And in the interim, Iraq is like better, but the problems hadn't been solved, of course. And his family's still there living it out, and like, struggling a bit, and then ISIS kind of rises for all the reasons we could talk about on like a different, more policy-oriented pod. But ISIS rises, seizes all of the Sunni areas, like Western Iraq, Fallujah, Ramadi, all these cities we bled for the American army, and then Mosul, which is the Chicago second city, kind of Iraq, falls. All of northern Iraq falls. They get within, you know, like an hour's drive of Baghdad. Eastern Baghdad is full of Shia who are going to be there's going to be a pogrom. There's going to be a massacre is the idea. And there probably would have been if ISIS gets in. And so the Iraqi army has collapsed. So now these Shia clerics, quietists, they call them, the ones who don't get involved in politics a lot. Most important one is Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani. Shia cleric, most famous, most popular one, most credibility. Says, and this is, you know, 2014-15, says height of ISIS rise, you know, all that. He says, you know, all Shia men like have to pick up a rifle and like go to the front and protect our communities and our women from being like massacred by like these crazy ISIS types. And so Akil's younger brother, who was actually a kid, I mean, it could have been his school books that I was being taught Arabic on, you know, Akil's got a million brothers and sisters. They're like the Irish Catholics of Iraq, the Shia, trust me. They're like the Shanty Irish of Sadr City. But, you know, he's older now. Like, he's like a young guy, like 20s, you know, like, and, you know, he's a militiaman. He he joins these unofficial militias that are like kind of cashiered sort of into the Iraqi army, but not really. They're like tacitly controlled. He goes to the front to fight ISIS, gets shot in the leg, you know, and, you know, returns back to his neighborhood. And so that's kind of like the epilogue, right, in some ways. And it's an ongoing one because there's still like a low level, like low boiling insurgency that's going on. And so, yeah, Akil comes to Thanksgiving and Christmas at my family's in Staten Island. It's a bizarre world because sometimes I think back to the first time I met him and like where we were, how young we were, how odd our cultures were so far apart. And like now he spends like every Thanksgiving with like my cop firemen, like chauvinist uncles who love him and adore him and they'd agree about nothing. And like he calls my mom and they like kiss, like it's, and I guess like, so I've stayed in touch with him and he's like a part of my family now in a way. And so, yeah, I mean, and I've, you know, and so now I have some connection to his family and I think that, you know, we'll talk about it in detail, of course, but there's like a story about that epilogue that's kind of missing, you know, like that war with ISIS and the militias and there were American special forces and drones and pilots. And it's just like, it's a super fascinating story and it's like the war come home and then boomerang back.
So Akil was an interpreter in what we're now calling Iraq 2. We call Iraq 1, right, the Gulf War, Big Daddy Bush with Kuwait in 91. And Iraq 2 is the George W. Bush war in beginning in 2003, still going on. And then there's now Iraq 3, which I guess is, what are we, I mean, that's the war on ISIS, I suppose, right? Is how we're, that's what we're saying now. And that war, I mean, it might be over in a way. ISIS isn't gone completely, but they no longer hold any territory, significant territory. And that is because a ground war was launched, I guess, in 2014, 2015 by Obama. That's and right. Then finished by Trump pretty much right after he took office. He took care of this. So Mosul and Raqqa and Fallujah were held by ISIS, as you were saying. And there was, as we're told, you know, major ground wars to retake these large cities. But there's been almost no reporting on this thing, which I've said many, many times on this show and elsewhere, is a goddamn outrage that I've never seen video. I know there's like one or two little videos here and there, but no one has ever told the story of this whole war within a war. The war against ISIS, taking cities house by house. I know, and you know, that that's dirty business. And I would really like to see how that went down. And a lot of it was directed, as you said, by U.S. troops, special operations forces. So, and U.S. planes dropping bombs on those cities. So it was direct involvement by the United States. And no journalist has ever told this story. Isn't it just shocking? Like,
it is. And it's important to understand, like, Fallujah, November 2004, was, like, the biggest battle of the Iraq War, the most conventional. And I will tell you that what happened in Mosul, in terms of the number of people killed and the damage done to the city, makes Fallujah, like, pale in comparison. Okay, you have to understand, like, Mosul, I mean, Fallujah looked terrible when it was all done, no doubt. But, like, Mosul's a way bigger city. Fallujah's, like, you know, the equivalent of like taking Newark versus taking Chicago, you know what I mean? Yeah. In terms of size. And I mean, Mosul, the half of Mosul on the side of the river, the old city, it looks like Stalingrad. And the battle was a lot like taking Berlin if you're a Soviet soldier. I mean, it was that intense. And yet it's a story we don't know.
Don't know.
Much of which is directed by U.S. troops and fought by, in many cases, Iraqi Shia.
Yep.
This is not Akil's family. They were not of this flavor of Shia, but a lot of the people who went to the front and the militias and won this war were acolytes and sympathizers with Muqtada al-Sadr, who was the Shia demagogue of the poor, who was a nationalist, still is a nationalist, an anti-American. Mm-hmm. And it was his Mahdi army militia which killed the soldiers that I mentioned, Alex and Michael, on January 25th, 2007. Militia. And the April 2004 Sadr City Uprising that like bloodied the nose of the 1st Cavalry Division of the United States Army, those were the folks. And now in 2014, through expediency and just drama of like Baghdad might fall, those folks made up a good portion of the people on our side working beside our special forces to fight ISIS. And so I think that there is a microcosm of the complexity and almost absurdity of like what happens post regime change, American war, that these sides keep changing, right? Yeah. And a person like Akhil, whose life was unexpectedly touched by the American army and transformed by it, not just because he ends up in the United States, but like his brother ends up fighting and being wounded in this war, who was a kid when America invaded.
Yeah, like I remember. Remember when ISIS raised its head in whatever it was, 2014, 15, I guess, and everybody was talking about ISIS. That was the thing. And the beheading videos were coming out and everybody was talking about ISIS, and ISIS was the boogeyman. It totally replaced Al-Qaeda. And then Obama just sort of quietly went to war. And then Trump said, oh no, I'm going to finish Obama's war against these guys. We're definitely kicking them out of the box. And if you can, you look at the casualty numbers, which are all estimates, but you can see that they're rising through Obama in those areas that are being retaken, those cities, Mosul and Raqqa and Fallujah. But then almost as soon as Trump takes power, the civilian or just the casualty rates just spike, but like only for about a month. I think it was the summer of 2017, right? Mm-hmm. Spike for like a month or two and then down to almost nothing and since then. And so clearly there was like this orgy of violence and killing in about a month or two period. And then it's just done and we don't talk about it anymore. Like there was a whole war basically that went on and no one was aware of it. Even I, as I've said, I've never seen video footage. I've never seen real, I've never seen the story told. I don't know what went on. I can guess, but like what went on house to house? Like what did the fighting look like? How many people died? How many civilians were killed? Mm-hmm. What exactly were US troops doing? What did those bombs do to human bodies, et cetera? You know, but none of that. It's we are so deaf, dumb, and blind to foreign policy and war that we're not even telling stories of entire wars that we just conducted and won.
If I can, I've just thought of this, and now we've talked about this a bunch, but I have.
Amazing.
I've decided I like lists. I've decided on why I could think of maybe three reasons for that.
Okay.
And why there's no attention paid. And they're not, this isn't exclusionary. There might be more, but I can think of three. Number one, there's no Americans dying anymore.
Right.
We're very careful about keeping the casualties down. Special forces guys that I know have basically told me that their instructions were get as close as you need to get to win, to get close enough to get the airstrikes where they need to go, but don't you dare fucking die on us. Mm-hmm. Don't you dare be in the New York Times tomorrow. I mean, literally. Mm-hmm. And the second reason is like there was no easy sides. Because even though ISIS was bad, if you spend too much time talking about who's doing the fighting on our side, you might have to mention that like the guys who used to kill Americans are on your side, and it's like, this is ugly. America's wars create disasters, but I don't even think that's the main reason. I think the third, and this is uncomfortable, my liberal friends will be mad, but they already hate me. We can't give a win to Trump, okay? And I'm not even necessarily saying that Trump deserves a win. Like, maybe he even was obscene in the way he opened up the bombing. But if Trump does, in fact, spike the casualties in the effort of destroying ISIS, even if it was Obama who did most of the work, but Trump closed it out, we can't give Trump a win. And so there's this sense that like, we're just not going to talk about it. We can't. I think that the combination of those three reasons, I don't know. I've not seen that in print. Have you seen somebody lay out like, hey, Mosul wasn't talked about and I've got three hypotheses.
No.
I haven't seen it. And I just made it up now.
No.
I just made that up. Like, but I think it's real.
No, it's the invisible war. It's the invisible war that we just fought and we won and we're not even talking about it. And I think you're right. I think it's just partisan bullshit that's stopping most of the media from talking about it. What happened when Obama offed Osama, right? It was like a giant national party.
USA.
People were literally partying in the streets of every city. Trump defeats worse guys than Al-Qaeda, right? These are the worst guys ever in history, you could argue, right? And he wipes them out. And I'm not saying he should be celebrated for it at all, but I'm saying there was no talk about it. It's just our political culture, especially about foreign policy and war, is so psychotic.
Yeah, it all depends on which emperor is in charge. Like if your favorite emperor is in charge, then you can celebrate.
Good Lord, man. Anyway, I have learned a lot from you just talking today and am inspired by you. And I think you have a tremendous amount of talent. And all I want for you is for you to get bigger and bigger and better known. And I want your work to be out there because I think of all the people, and I know a lot of people in the anti-war movement, I just think that you can be one of our best messengers. I think you already are, but you know, the more you're out there, the better. Cause you tell the story, you've got the credentials, you've got the receipts like no one else, man. And you're just so good at telling a story and you know the history, you know this stuff on an intellectual level, on a visceral level. you just think you have the complete package, Danny. So I hope, you know, someday that we can do something together and maybe tell some stories that haven't been told before.
Well, I think there's nobody better positioned than you and I together, man, because I mean, I think we share sort of like a vision and like a really? You know, intellectual and sort of emotional kinship on this. And I'm just glad to do this and that we got to know each other. And let's see where we take this, right? There's a lot of stories to tell. Maybe we'll
totally. Totally. Very exciting. I'm so glad to have met you. Thanks for doing this show.
Glad to do it. Thanks for having me.
I'll see you soon, man. Okay. Take care, Danny. Peace.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To join the new Renegade University, go to renegadeuniversity.com. To join the new Unregistered Underground, the supporting listeners group for the podcast, go to unregisteredunderground.com. Thanks for listening.